Cliff, you're up. Cliff, you're going to go first. They're not. I don't know. I don't. So that means stop talking. Sorry, just say okay. Everyone, very excited to be here today. I'm going to. Okay, really, does mean stop talking. So we don't have a quorum, so we are going to first open a. Do you want to talk about it in the context of 2255 or just generally?
Generally works. Either works.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Still no quorum. Well, let's open up a public hearing just for the purposes of receiving Representative Bent's testimony about one small part of 2255 that also was intended by him to be in some other bills, but we told him to work within the context of this bill before it got so controversial. So I would argue that's probably not his fault that it got controversial, but why don't you talk about it, and then we'll recess that hearing, do some other business, and get back to 2255 later in the hearing. But this is for those of you listening. Excuse me. For those of you listening on the phone, and this is a courtesy we extend to other members who have other schedules and other meetings to just speak at the beginning of the meeting so they can go about their business, and then everybody else will still have a chance after they hear about the bills in more detail to comment from the public. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cliff Bentz, District 60. The handout that I've just asked to be delivered to committee members, and thank you, Mr. Chair, by the way, for giving me this opportunity to appear before you and present this concept. You'll see that I have a copy of the Malheur County area, and the idea is to reflect the challenge that Malheur County faces. The first photo is an overhead photograph of the Treasure Valley area, which is Malheur County, and then Boise, which is within 43 miles of Ontario. And in that valley, there are about 600,000 people on the Idaho side of the river within 40 miles of Ontario. There are 30,000 people on the Malheur County side. If you'll turn the page to the second chart, you'll see a summary of the size of Malheur County. It's 6,355,200 acres. There are 277 of this 6,355,000 acres zoned industrial. And up until recently, we had 75 acres of industrial land, the largest parcel available. There are 200 acres we hope that will come into that inventory, raising our total out of the 6,300,000 acres. We would have 477 zoned industrial, leaving us real close to 6,350,000 acres available for other uses. The point is obvious. The next sheet, Mr. Chair, shows comparative growth rates between Malheur County on the Oregon side, which is almost nothing, and on the Idaho side, which is nothing short of astounding. And many differences, I suppose, lead to that result, but one of them is the lack of Malheur County's ability to respond quickly to opportunities. And in small counties across my five-county district, we have a situation where opportunity is fleeting, and you have to be ready. You can't wait for someone to knock on the door and then take 3 years to respond, or 2 years to respond, or even a year, even 6 months to respond. You have to be ready. And one thing that we've learned is that people drive in, they say, "Have you got a space ready?" And we say, "No, but if you'll wait, we can get one." And they go, "Bye," and they're gone. And that means that we have to anticipate their arrival. We cannot respond. This bill, 2255, is an excellent effort to try to address this kind of situation, except that it too, although it tries to streamline a very good process, is reactive to someone knocking on the door and asking. That works really well in a seller's market like Portland or other large areas where there's high demand. We are a buyer's market, always have been a buyer's market, always will be a buyer's market. We have to be ready. Our system is not designed for that type of quick response, sadly. I'm happy to report that with the good work of DLCD and the local community, additional acres have recently been added to our industrial land base, thank goodness, because we have lost opportunities because we only had a 75-acre parcel. And the problem, of course, is if you only have one parcel, the price skyrockets. And thus, when we did have an opportunity, the people held out for more money and the opportunity left. So you've got to have more than one parcel. You've got to have a bunch so that the competition among those parcels will drive down the price and people will actually show up. Well, one of the serious weaknesses in Oregon's system of planning, which all of us have become accustomed to it and all of us know that it's not going to go away, but one of the weaknesses in it is that it doesn't allow for competition. And as a result, we price ourselves out of many of the markets that are available, particularly if they're about 100 yards away in Idaho. And this is what's happening to Malheur County now. Thus, the addition to the last page of the bill that's in front of you, which calls out Malheur County in particular and only, and says that the county court would be given the opportunity to identify up to three parcels, none exceeding 1,000 acres in size, in the event that something would happen. I would remind those in the audience that we have 6 million acres in Malheur County. 6 million acres in Malheur County. I'm going to say it again. I've got 6 million acres in Malheur County, 250 of which are zoned industrial. We are rich in space, and you know what? It's mostly empty because we don't have the opportunity given to us to have jobs. We have the poorest county in Oregon. The poverty rate is 22%, and we are right next to Idaho. It's growing like a weed. There's something wrong, and one of the things we might be able to do is give our county court the opportunity to respond to a very large industrial user. And with that, Mr. Chair, happy to take questions and then run back to my committee.
Any questions for Representative Benz? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Benz, we received a lot of testimony in written form over the last couple days in regard to this bill that the current planning process that we employ in the state of Oregon works well. It reserves plenty of industrial land in an equitable way for all of Oregon's counties. What would your response be to that assertion?
Well, I was about to ask what world they came from, but I'll simply say this. When we have had opportunities that we needed a quick response to, our system was incapable of responding in any way that was fast. And by fast, I mean within 6 months. Instead, I'm going to say what we were told would take 90 days took a year, or 2 years, or never. And so the response is, and there's another huge problem. If you're going to engage in the type of planning mechanism that we have created to protect the expectations justifiably emerging as a result of a very, very complicated planning process, you need money. My small communities don't have it. They're all broke. My little towns of Vail don't have $150,000, $200,000, $300,000 to go hire all kinds of experts. They don't have that kind of money. Ontario had to get $100,000 to pay for the work to add 200 acres to its industrial land base. Where do you think it got the 100,000? It went to the city and we took it away from the swimming pool. So what is that? So yes, we need planning. Yes, we need to do this stuff carefully. But there has to be a recognition of the fact that we don't have all kinds of money in my little towns. And what's happened ever since we had this planning thing is our little towns are frozen in time. You drive over the mountain out of Bend going into my district. And keep in mind, my home is 5 hours from Bend in driving time. When you finally get there, you'll see every town as though it was existent 30 years ago. Nothing's changed. And the fact of the matter is people don't have hundreds of thousands of dollars to engage in this kind of planning process, which works, I'm sure, wonderfully for places that do have lots of money. Actually, I'm not sure wonderful. I have to answer your question. And forgive my answer being so long. But the truth of it is, this is a problem. It needs to be addressed. Thanks for your question.
Okay, anything else? Back to committee for you, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your patience.
So I am going to, I'm not going to try this again. This happened the other day. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2255 and we'll reopen it a little bit later. Let me open a public hearing on Senate Bill 517 and ask our proponents to come up.
Yeah, there's only one.
Gary.
Yep.
Yes. This will be quick. really quick.
Understood.
It's going to be great. It's a Senate bill, 30-0. It's really easy. Here we go.
Chair,
by yourself
for the
record. Yeah.
My name is Reed Wagner. I'm the executive director of the Multnomah County Drainage District, and I also serve three other drainage districts along the Columbia River. We're facing some pretty serious challenges when it comes to new federal regulations coming our way and the mounting costs along with them. So public participation is more important probably than ever before. I have four elected boards. They consist of residents, business owners, and those representing public lands. The public entities have differences of opinions in interpreting our statute as to whether or not they need to send board members or they can send staff people to serve as elected officials and as voting members of the board. This adjustment to the statute would provide more clarity and allow these public boards to send the most appropriate representative from the organization to serve on the board.
Okay. Any questions about that for Ms. Reed Wagner?
Yes.
Mr. Wagner. Okay. Okay, thank you. And looking to my list, it's just you, Reed. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 517. Do I have a quorum? I do.
There we go.
Okay, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 517. Do we have the paperwork?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 517 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Cameron moves Senate Bill 517 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mm-hmm. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Davis.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Cliffhanger.
Patrick.
Aye.
Representative Unger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cameron.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Excused.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Bill passes and Senate Bill 517 is sent to the floor. Consent calendar, fine with anyone? Any objections? On the consent calendar it goes. Okay, now we are here.
Bill, you could have carried.
I was just going to say.
Everybody else should be here to talk about House Bills 2253, 2254, and 2255. We had a public hearing, but now there's amendments, which people have either seen or not seen. So we're going to hear about the amendments, and then we'll have the public comment on the bills after we hear about what these amendments are. In mass, probably. All three at the same time? Nope. In order. Okay, we're going to open a public hearing first on House Bill 2253, and we're going to hear about that first, these amendments, from the director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
Chair Clem, members, for the record, Jim Rue, Director of Department of Land Conservation and Development. As the chair has said, we've been here before. Related to 2253, there have been very few changes. There has been a minor change that attempts to ensure that all communities and interested citizens are notified at the time that PSU begins taking comment on the forecast. You'll hear more from both the League of Cities and a representative from the Population Research Center to that effect. So I'm not going to say any more about it now. That is the only change since we were here a couple of weeks ago. And on behalf of the department, I simply urge you to pass the bill. So thank you.
Any questions? Those changes about the notification, were some of those in response to what Marion County had spoke to me about, at least?
Chair Clem, yes, and others weighed in with other concerns. I think it is our opinion that those issues can get addressed in rulemaking.
Okay, sounds good. Any questions for Jim? Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. Jim, This bill doesn't have a fiscal on it, but this 54 does. Is that right? Or is this bill going to Ways and Means next? I guess is maybe my question.
We don't have any paperwork back to even say fiscal or no fiscal yet.
Right.
Although you might have a hint at that.
Representative Unger, we We originally included this in the policy option package that we have. If you remember, it came up in Ways and Means Sub. There will undoubtedly be some rulemaking at Portland State, and I think that they can talk about a fiscal, but it will be minimal for us.
So follow up.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair. Director, so then how will this work? There is a policy option package that exists in your budget right now. This bill will exist independently of that, and then it'll be up to the subcommittee to figure out whether or not we fund the policy option package to make this work. So your way you're looking at this is we're going to put this into law regardless of the money, and if we get the money, that'll be really good because then it'll be useful. Is that how you're looking at it?
Chair Clem, Rep. Unger, you have rightly characterized that there are a fair number of moving pieces here. But, yeah, we hope they align.
Thank you.
And then we've got about 9 additional witnesses on this one. All appear to be in support of it. So why don't we just have the first one come up, Jason Jurjevich, and then Stephen Kafori and Barton Brierley. Yeah. Okay. Please. And then we'll come to you on the phone here in a moment, Damian.
Sure. Two of you watch together?
Yeah, please. Yep. Most people are here, I think, on the last bill, so we'll try and get through the happy people on this bill so we can hear about the others a little bit. Okay. Jason.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Jurjevich. I'm acting director of the Population Research Center at Portland State University. I do not have any written testimony to submit at this time. I submitted a written testimony in the previous hearing, so I'm here to answer any questions that you might have specific to the population aspects of the bill.
Great. And Stephen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Gaffari. I represent the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We've been involved in these three bills. We support the bill with the -1 amendments and look forward to finally getting rid of this problem.
Okay.
I'm Barton Brierley. I'm the Planning and Building Director for the City of Newburgh, and we've done a number of efforts to update our comprehensive plan and do long-range planning, and on our most recent effort, our choices on coordinated population forecasts were use a county population forecast that was done in 1994, which is about 19 years ago, or you can use the Safe Harbor, which is the OEA forecast, but OEA stop doing long-range forecasts. The last one you can use is 2004, so that's not very useful. So doing the population forecasts, while it is a science, it's not that complicated. It can be done.
I'm watching the scientist over here. He's like, oh yeah, you want to come work my computers? Sorry, go ahead.
It's just something that needs to get done, and this is a way that it will get done. And so we support this amendment.
Okay. Any questions for you three?
Yeah, just yep. One.
Representative Fetcher.
Especially since he's from the city that I represent. Are there any concerns at all? Because I've heard them from some constituents saying, well, you know, PSU, I mean, that's just as, they might have some sort of agenda. I don't know. There's a concern that maybe just going to one choice and not having these choices would be an unfavorable thing for planners, perhaps. I don't know. I would like to hear from you.
Well, we've used we used Portland State for a previous population study. I know the county just recently used them for an updated study, and they use good scientific methods. It's an acceptable outcome.
And this would, thank you, and this would allow for more up-to-date population forecast. And cost-wise, what does that mean to the City of Newburgh?
It means that we don't have to then hire them or hire someone else to do the same forecast. So the money is all being spent. It's actually probably cheaper to do it kind of en masse than each individual city and each individual county doing one.
Thank you.
Can we send you and some of your money to Malheur County? got a little problem.
Is he listening?
It's a nice vacation spot, a few weeks, and okay. Anything else?
One quick thing. Thanks, Chair Clem. The professor and I have been going back and forth on the population forecast issue. I think when Representative Thatcher was talking about, some people are concerned. I think she, had been a little bit concerned. But could you maybe share with the committee some of the, last time you were here, we talked about the accuracy of the forecasts and how good of a job PSU has done in the past. And since that time, you shared with me, and I don't know if you shared with the rest of the committee, a little bit more detail about how well PSU has done. I think it would be useful at least to speak for a minute about that, if you could.
Sure. Chair Clem, Representative Unger, I can make that available to the entire committee if folks would like. It was a forecast that was done in the 1990s by our center. That was a 20-year forecast, so it went out to 2010. So we were able to compare the results of that forecast with Census 2000 data and Census 2010 data, and I can make that spreadsheet available to the committee.
That'd be pretty close, roughly.
Yeah, pretty.
A little preview for us. We're hanging on the edge.
I can say that. If you have it right there.
I do. Of course, as the forecast gets longer, there's more uncertainty around the numbers with respect to the forecast. The forecast was issued in 1993, and in Census 2000, approximately 50% of the counties were within 3% of the number. 60% were within 5% of actual, and 90% were within 10% of the Census 2000 number. In Census 2010, about a third were within 3%, 53% were within 5%, and 70% were within 10% of the actual Census 2010 number. Again, I know that's a lot of numbers, so I can make that available to the committee.
One quick follow-up. How does that compare with the population forecast that we currently have from the wide variety of different sources?
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, great question, in the sense that this, I can't speak to the exact methods that were used with respect to this forecast, besides the fact that it is a cohort component methodology, which is the standard methodology that we still use here at the center. But in terms of the data inputs that were put into this forecast versus the inputs that we would use for Yamhill County or the city of Newburg, I would argue that it's much more comprehensive in terms of the data that we're soliciting in these forecasts than what was used for this forecast. And so what I'm trying to say is I think that this is sort of an automated forecast with respect to just inputting basic fertility, mortality, migration data, and maybe not as much consultation around comprehensive plans, economic forecasts, current land use planning, future zoning, those sorts of things that would make it a more comprehensive forecast.
Okay, anything else? Okay. Vice Chair Cameron.
Just maybe one question. You mentioned a lot of different variances. How did the overall state come out in that comparison? Because you said percentages off. Some could have been up. Some could have been down. And I don't know. I didn't do too well on statistics, but there's a number that goes down the middle of that.
Chair Clem, Representative Cameron, to answer your question, sir, the state's total in 2000 was within 63,000. Of the 3.4 million Oregonians in 2000, so that was an error of 1.9%. And in 2010, we were within 57,396 of the 3.8 million Oregonians, which is a 1.5% error.
Follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. Yeah, 63,000, that's one house district.
Okay. Are you a demographer? Is that what we call you?
But demographer, population, geographer.
Okay.
Demagogue.
It's nice. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Thank you for your work on this. And let's get Drake. Butch.
I know.
Butch. And Aaron Doyle and Mike Eliason.
I want to see if you get the numbers. For what?
The numbers that he gave you?
Yes.
We'll go quickly if we can, because there are a lot of excited people here. 19, in fact, for later. Drake.
Chairman Clem, I'm Drake Butch. I am the Secretary Vice President of the Portland Home Builders Association and also a director of the State Home Builders Association, and I'm kind of here on the behalf of John Chandler.
Right, I'm looking for him. Where is he? I miss him.
Yeah, I probably am also famous for having hired him at one point.
Oh boy. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. We'll talk offline when the. Yeah. Yeah.
The Homeboat Association wishes to testify in support of 2253. We feel a couple of great items coming out of this. One is it takes a portion of this out of an appeal, out of the appealable portions, so it's going to hopefully create a system that's smoother and not have such a problem of actually delaying or hindering the process. The other one is that we really like to see in this is that this it creates a common set of data so that everybody's using the same set. You don't have one person choosing to go one place for data and another for another. And getting these SKUs in it, especially as we start to work in regions more, I think it's very important that these all come together as one. And by using one single set of data and one single source, it'll take out all of that confusion that occurs between who you chose and what occurred. I also think it does take some of the agenda out of it to address some of your concerns in that it's not a local decision trying to find the right answer to meet their local want. It'll be more driven by a statewide set. So I think those things all add up to make this really a lot better solution for everybody.
Sounds good to me. And Aaron, please.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. We testified in the first public hearing that we're definitely in support of this. This is the population forecast is an important first step in the land use process, and this bill will help us get that step completed without fear of having to come back and start the whole process again if the decision is appealed. Also, to Representative Thatcher's question, there is a section in Section 2, Sub 8, if there's concerns that PSU is not doing up to snuff, that the DLCD may put together a board of folks who do this for a living to kind of look at the processes going forward. So if there is a fear that suddenly PSU has developed an agenda that is out there, then it's a possibility for the DLCD to address that issue. In addition, it's a cost saving so that we don't have to turn to the safe harbor or do these ourselves if we don't have up-to-date from the county. So for those reasons, we're very supportive of the Dash 1 and have been part of that process.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. After working through a lot of discussion and some initial hesitation about giving up our coordination authority, it's pretty clear at this point that the positives fairly clearly outweigh the negatives with this. The more frequent updates, the responsibility, or basically the economy of scale in doing this on a statewide basis, the removing the forecast from being a land use decision, therefore not appealable to LUBA. And frankly, many counties that do the forecast already contract with PSU to do the forecast anyway. So at this time, I think we're fairly comfortable with where the bill sits.
Okay. Any questions? Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. Maybe the cities or the counties, are you comfortable with the notice and the 45-day window of appeal process that's set up in the Dash?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Cameron, yes, we are, because the whole process is more collaborative. The way that PSU has presented how they do these is actually within the first 2 months, there will be an opportunity for the public and local governments to be involved and submit data and information regarding all of those other land use decisions, future plans, comprehensive plans, zoning, economic development that we're doing, and work through the entire period in which they're doing the forecast. In addition, my understanding is there will be preliminary drafts that will have a period of review before that final draft that gives that 45-day review period, which will then lead to an actual final. So through those 12 months in which they're doing the forecast, cities and counties and private citizens will all have an opportunity to provide more and more information to PSU. So that makes us very comfortable.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Cameron, if I may, that has been a topic of discussion. You know, what should the number be, 45, 60, several other numbers have been thrown out there. I think because of what Ms. Doyle talked about in terms of some of the early outreach leading up to when the actual notices go out, and the fact that the longer we push out some of these deadlines, it starts to, I think, potentially affect PSU. They're on a rotating cycle of doing these, many of these each year, and then going into the next year doing another round for another set of counties and cities. That has been a topic of discussion, and I think the majority of folks are probably satisfied with where it is at this point. But it's certainly been talked about trying to lengthen that out a little bit further.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. It kind of sparked a question, Aaron, when you were addressing, you were talking about how the process happens now, and PSU does this, and that's kind of the process. And I just kind of want to make sure or inquire about, what if there's a bunch of infiltrators from, say, Idaho that would really love to gum us up because it helps them out somehow, and if they were suddenly in charge of this program over at PSU, and if they should decide to change how they're doing things, can they do that, or is this totally overseen by the DLCD? What is the oversight in making sure that this program goes on in a process that is, going well like it is now?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, I think that the DLCD and PSU are working on the exact oversight. There will be rulemaking by both the State Board of Education and by DLCD regarding these population forecasting processes. I don't think that any one interest group can hijack the process, because every interest group is allowed to weigh in, and PSU can look at the information and the basis for why that information was supplied, and judge the information accordingly. So I don't think that the process can be hijacked by one group outside of the local interest.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Mary Kyle, and then Damien, you're our final speaker here after Mary Kyle's done. Surprised you went for this. Why don't you tell us about why you support it?
We supported it when it was up before you, before Chair Clem and members of the committee.
No Luba appeal, wow.
Chair Clem and members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'd like to not have a job. You've heard already from other speakers why this is an improvement for a coordinated, updated, less expensive way of doing population forecasts. But I want to emphasize one aspect of this, that this was put together by a diverse group of interests and individuals in an advisory committee that lasted well over a year. It was facilitated by the Oregon Consensus Project. And in the beginning, I think everyone part of that committee, and we participated in that, thought it was going to be unworkable and we wouldn't reach a conclusion, but a consensus. But because they had the time to deliberate, discuss, and test whether certain variables were going to work, they have come to a consensus that this is a workable and better alternative and less expensive alternative than the current practice. And that's a real benefit of that process, of taking the time that's needed to get to a consensus. And not only have they reached agreement, it's a better agreement. It's a better process than what we have today, and you've already heard testimony about that, so I won't go into that. Thank you.
Questions for Mary Kyle? I think you can go. And I'm just teasing you. You have been exceptionally helpful in many issues over the last several years cutting deals. We have Big Look Task Force deals. We had all kinds of deals. So I shouldn't tease you like that. But I think you've been
great.
Thank
you, Chair Clem.
We'll talk to you again on 2255 in a few minutes. Okay. Damien. Hello?
Hello, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify again remotely. My name is Damien Cernick. I'm a senior planner with the City of Bend, and I was a member that participated with the core group that developed the proposal before you today. I'll be brief and just want to let you know I support the proposed -1 amendments. One of the things I wanted to further elaborate on is the support for having PSU do this work. They're an agency that we turn to for demographic data, often in our work as local planners, and we find their work very reliable, particularly with the work they do on yearly estimates. So I wanted to share with you that I'm very comfortable with them doing the work, and that establishing them really reduces the risk that we get data that's either artificially inflated or deflated, and thereby biases some of our planning work. I would ask you to move the bill to the House floor with a DPAS recommendation, and I would be very happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay, any questions for Damian? Damian, today we don't have the paperwork to do your last request, but I'm sure as soon as we get it, we'll be able to do that. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay. That is everybody on my list for 2253. So with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2253 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2254 and ask Mr. Whitman to come talk about the amendments. Heard the concept in our other public hearing, and we're excited to hear what's happened since then. And lots of people for it as well afterwards.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resources Advisor, here today to testify on House Bill 2254-2. Just to be clear, it's the dash two amendments that it's the dash one amendments that you're considering. I'm getting ahead of myself. That's the next bill, which shall not be named right now. So, with regard to House Bill 2254, I want to just refresh your memory a little bit. This bill, in my humble opinion, is the most significant streamlining bill before the legislature in this session in the regulatory process. I think it really has the potential to ease many of the difficulties we've had, the fights that we've had over urban growth boundary amendments, while staying true to both the need for our cities to grow and be healthy and the need to continue to protect our agricultural and forest industries. So I think it's really a significant piece of legislation. And it's very significant that you have see before you a consensus around this legislation. We have worked very hard for over a year, as Ms. McCurdy testified, through a consensus-based process to try to address everyone's concerns with this bill. It is not a mandate. This is an option, a tool that local governments can use. And we believe that if it is implemented as we intend it to be implemented, it's a tool that local governments will use because it will save time, money, and it will make clear to residents of communities what the key parts of decisions are about the future of cities. So getting to the specifics of the amendments in dash one, they're completely consistent with what we testified to when we had our first public hearing on this bill. There are no significant changes in the amendments from the concepts that we presented to the committee. There are a couple of things that I would just like to state for the record that I know have caused some questions from a few people about the dash one amendments. First of all, in section, let me just a sec here, section six of the dash one amendments dealing with urban service agreements. And by the way, you have a section by, you should have a section by section analysis in front of you that helps you go through the major parts of the bill. Section 6 dealing with urban service agreements. This is these provisions were worked out through a mediated process between the cities and the districts. over how to deal with a part of the land use system that has become increasingly problematic over the year, and that over the years, and that is agreements about who is going to provide what urban services to what areas within urban growth boundaries. It's become more and more of a problem over the years. Section 6 sets up a process to address that going forward for new urban growth boundary amendments. It does not deal with existing situations. But going forward, it sets up a requirement for cities to notify districts of a proposed urban growth boundary amendment and to give those districts an opportunity to say whether or not they want to enter into an urban services agreement. There are some concerns with the language in Section 6 from the districts, I think, in particular, that we make sure that notice is actually received by the districts and that they have an opportunity to respond within that 60-day period and tell the city whether or not they want an urban service agreement. So I just want to make it clear for the record that in the rulemaking process for implementation of this legislation, we would expect the Land Conservation and Development Commission to include provisions requiring notice to be done, certified, return receipt, so that we assure that the districts have actually received notice. It's gotten in the right hands of the district, and they have an opportunity to make a decision about whether or not they want to enter into negotiations for an urban services agreement with the city. The second piece that I want to touch on for just a second is in Section 8 on judicial review. One of the main features of this bill is that it would move review of urban growth boundary decisions for the larger cities from the Land Conservation and Development Commission over to the Land Use Board of Appeals, which frankly has the better expertise to review these types of decisions. There has been a bit of concern about whether or not the Land Use Board of Appeals has the authority when they're reviewing one of these decisions, if they find parts of it have a problem, parts of it are okay, whether they can distinguish between those aspects of the decision and let the city go ahead with the parts of the decision that are okay, and essentially, if there are things that need to be fixed, send those parts back to the city, but let the city go forward with the parts that are okay. We believe that authority exists for the Land Use Board of Appeals, and that that's part of the judicial review that would occur under the statute. So those are the two details that I wanted to focus on, where there have just been a few questions from some of the participants in our work group. Other than that, I am not aware of any significant concerns with this legislation at this point. And so I'm going to stop there, and I'm available to answer any questions that you might have regarding this bill.
I'm sure we'll have some. The one I wanted to ask was, I was thinking about what Representative Benz had to say, and it seems like there might be some relief here even to cities who want to make more land available through a UGB expansion, in this bill's case, through the expedited process. Do you think there's some relief versus the other approach, which is just to try and create some more outside the UGB through some other process?
Chair Clem, I think there could be relief through this bill. It certainly would enable the City of Ontario, just like other cities, to, if they choose to use this process, to do an urban growth boundary amendment for employment uses or for residential uses in a way that should be significantly faster and cheaper than the traditional way. And you heard those concerns from Representative Bence about our general system. Mm-hmm. When we talk about the next bill, we will give you a little bit more specific detail about the City of Ontario.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Richard, for being here.
Yeah.
I have a question about Section 5. Just to clarify and maybe add to the legislative intent and history. So this is for Section 5 of the -1 amendment is regarding a city outside of Metro that has a population of 10,000 or more. And the commission shall design a method so that the city using the method A
will have within its boundaries sufficient buildable lands for essentially a 14-year population growth period. I assume that population growth is hopefully going to come from PSU. Is that correct?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, it will, and I'm cheating a little bit, but if you'll indulge me, in part referring to the question from Representative Unger earlier, that forecast will come regardless of whether or not money is appropriated for that policy option package. The wording of House Bill 2253 requires that the Department of Land Conservation and Development allocate money from its existing grant program for the population forecast, and that's true whether or not the POP is funded. Just FYI. So, in response to your question, Representative Davis, yes, it would be the population forecast done by PSU for that 14-year period.
Thank you, Philip. Moving to sub B of sub A. Will not become less efficient in its use of land. Could you explain the intent behind that?
Yes, Chair Clem, Representative Davis, again, this is direction to the Land Conservation and Development Commission about how it designs its rules. This is not a standard that a court or the Land Use Board of Appeals would apply to a particular decision of a particular city. It's a standard, if you will, for the rulemaking. In terms of the specifics about becoming less efficient, I know one issue that's been discussed in the work group is some of the land that is brought into the city will be for purposes like roads or parks or open space or schools. So the intent here is really with regard to residential land, residentially zoned land, that the rule be designed in a way so that the efficiency of land use for the residential lands within the city is not decreasing over time. It will be up to LCDC to work out the details of that in the rulemaking, but that's the general intent.
Follow up. Thanks. And the intent of that rulemaking will have efficiency based on both region and a particular jurisdiction, a particular city. So you're not going to take efficiency from the city of Portland and apply it to Ontario?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, that is absolutely correct. This one of the features of this bill has been to work very hard to focus the land use system on the big picture, how we're doing overall, not so much on individual city decisions, and to leave, frankly, more discretion to individual cities as long as the system overall is still going in the right direction.
Thank you. Let's move to sub C.
Okay.
The rate of conversion of agricultural and forest lands to urban uses does not increase over time in any major region of the state. Maybe you could talk about the intent behind that section.
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, yes, this is really just the flip side of what I just talked about. Again, we want to focus the Commission's rulemaking not on individual city decisions, but on how the system is performing in major areas of the state. And what we mean by that is areas like the Willamette Valley or the Oregon coast or southern Oregon. I think the expectation is there'll be probably five areas, and that would be the area that the Commission would focus on in terms of looking empirically at what the rate of change of land use is in those areas.
Follow up. This is a bit technical, but responding back to Representative Bent's dilemma in his district, one of the problems is that perhaps conversion has been difficult because they have not had the local funding to do UGB expansions. Does that make sense? So your conversion rate is going to be lower because, frankly, the jurisdictions haven't been able to do it. How might that be taken into account? Or is that an issue that I'm making up?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, I think there is discretion on the part of the commission in the wording of the statute in terms of the time period that we're looking over. That'll obviously be part of that calculation. The other part, just as a factual matter, and you're going to see a little bit of this when we present on the next bill, there have been some very significant urban growth boundary expansions in that part of the state fairly recently.
Okay. And follow-up. Thank you. I think this should be final.
Oh.
Thank you.
Oh.
Well, I shouldn't say that.
Oh.
This may be final.
Okay.
Thanks, Richard.
I'll yield.
This section contemplates that we know what that rate of conversion is, and there are discussions regarding a couple of bills about significant disagreement among significant stakeholders in the state over what the actual conversion rate is. How is that going to be determined?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, there are a couple ways that it could be determined. One is looking at the on the regulatory side at the plan and zone designations in a geographic sense. I think another way, and perhaps a more meaningful way, would be to look at the actual use on the ground and what has changed in terms of the actual uses, because we have lands that are planned and zoned for instance, and we're going to talk about these next, industrial use that are still in ranching or some form of farm use. We have the data now, and actually have had it for some time, from the Oregon Department of Forestry on actual acreage of actual land use across the state of Oregon. And frankly, we have it at five-year increments from 1974 to the current date. And this is great data. We talked about the data at our informational hearing right at the beginning of this legislative session that shows, you know, Frank, that Oregon has been quite a bit more efficient in its urbanization than neighboring states. And we actually have the data for most of the state of Washington also. So the commission will be able to choose a variety of different ways to look at conversion rates.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Holdy.
Thank you. I think Representative Davis and the answer has just confused me a little bit. So with this rate of conversion, I'm having a little bit of trouble of how you reconcile in Section 5, Sub 2, little a, with Sub 2, little c, where you're, you know, taking into consideration requiring them to meet a growth in population over a 14-year period, and then you're expecting that the rate of conversion won't increase. And so what if you have a dramatic increase in population in a certain area? I mean, I'm having trouble reconciling that, so I must be missing something.
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, it's looking at the change in population and the change in land area. So it's the ratio between those two. So if we've got a significant increase in population, but the land area required per person isn't increasing, that's what we're looking at.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah, that does it for me. Thanks.
Okay, right. Don't go too far, but you look like you've done a pretty good job.
All right. Well, thank you. Just last word, I really want to thank the members of the work group who've worked for over a year on this. People put in a lot of time on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Stephen, Jonathan, and Christy White, please join us at the dais. Stephen, you're up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cafori, representing the planners, land use planners. I just wanted to say the same thing. I don't want to repeat Mr. Whitman's testimony. We've been following this issue enormously closely. We like the Dash 1 amendments, and we hope to be involved with the rules that will need to be developed when the bill passes.
Jonathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jonathan Manton, testifying on behalf of Central Oregon Land Watch, and just want a very quick addition to add to the record. We weren't included in the in the work group for the last year, but so we're neutral on the bill officially, and just want to add for the record one change that we'd like to see. If it's too late to get it in amendment form now, then I want to just put it on the record so that we can work in the rules development in the agency processes as the rulemaking is done. And that would be on page 15 of the Dash 1 amendment. We're talking about lands that are subject to significant development hazards that would be excluded from the study area. We'd like to see risk of forest fire added to those that are enumerated. So right now it says the land subject to significant development hazards, including the risk of landslides, risk of flooding because the land is within a 100-year floodplain, or are subject to inundation during storm surges or tsunamis, and other risks determined by the commission. But one of those risks that's very obvious in our area in Bend, especially along the west side of Bend, is the proposed UGB expansion there. It abuts forest that is prone to burn. And so we would just like to see risk of forest fire added to those enumerated. Again, if it's too late to get that in amendment form now, then we'll look forward to pushing for that on the rulemaking process. I wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Okay. And Christy.
Good afternoon. Christy White, Chair and members of the committee. I was a member of the task force that tried to develop this concept as it's turned into this legislation. I'm speaking here in support. I'd like to echo a comment made earlier by Ms. McCurdy as well. When we started this task force on 2254, it was a diverse group of stakeholders, and as you looked around the table and started tackling these very tough issues, you could have lost faith that we would have been here today with a consensus approach on this bill, and I'm really happy to have stuck with that process and have reached that consensus and done the hard work that will help streamline this UGB process. I just want to highlight a few key points, one of which Mr. Whitman highlighted himself, which is it will be really important to ensure, as is already exists under 19783511, that LUBA, in its new jurisdiction over these UGB decisions, has the ability to partially affirm if it's going to remand a decision. There are so many sub-decisions that are made in a UGB decision. If you have one sub-decision that holds up the entirety, you're going to end up in a costly round of appeals and time delays. So I'm glad to emphasize on the record that ability to partially remand will be transferred to LUBA as it currently exists with LCDC when they're looking at a UGB amendment. The other thing that I think is something to note here is that these provisions maintain the exceptions to land priority in a way that makes a heck of a lot more sense and provides a lot more certainty and clarity for all participants in the process. And should the unfortunate circumstance exist that it's appealed, then at least you will have the clarity that this bill offers in when you consider each one of those exceptions. So I'll just end my testimony by saying this has been long argued in many, many court cases, and this process has become less and less certain, more and more costly, and taken more and more time. And I would agree with Mr. Whitman that this has the real potential to do some very, very important streamlining while still protecting the original goals of UGB amendments. Thank you.
Great. Questions for this panel?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Drake again, Aaron again, and Mark Landauer. Not again. Nice to see you, Mr. Landauer, for the first time today. Hello. Okay, Drake.
Again, I'm testifying on behalf of the Home Builders Association. I, too, participated in a lot of the meetings. It's not the first year we've done this. And I'd like to thank the governor's staff and LCDC staff for all their hard work on this. I mean, it took a lot of hours and all those people who gave of their own time. I mean, it was really impressive. The Home Builders does have some concerns, and we just want to make sure they get raised. One is... we feel like we're really stepping to the table in there's been a requirement for a 20-year land supply all along, and in this we're accepting a 14-year supply, but in return we're hoping to see that 7-year that has actual services to it increase our ability to actually go forward, so that we think it's a better trade-off. But it's one of those the department needs to understand that that's a big give, and we need to make sure that 7 years of available land that has services is actually there and serviced. I mean, that's one of the keys to this whole thing working. Again, in the kind of in the list of concerns, one of the things is we're moving a huge amount of work to LCDC, and a lot of trust. It's one thing at the legislature to, I mean, there's just so much detail in this stuff. I understand you guys can't do all that, but to have LCDC making all these rules and us having to work through that process, I mean, there's still a lot of trust on our part too, and we hope that everybody plays a good faith game from here forward, and that that commission remains, you know, balanced in its approach as it goes forward, because it's pretty spooky to be let. These are drastic changes in Oregon's system. I think they really are going to help small cities save time and money, but nonetheless, there's a fear, real fear factor. A lot of our members are pretty nervous about saying, "Oh, well, we trust LCDC to do this." You can imagine in small towns when you say that, they kind of say, "We're trusting who?" let's see, what are some of the other pieces. We think that one of the things that needs to be paid attention to is that in the future, the grants program is going to have to be followed closely with this program so that it works with those small jurisdictions in order for them to still have the money to do this. We think we're lowering those costs and making a better system, but we think it's still going to have to work closely hand-in-hand with the grants program that exists. This will require LCDC to be very vigilant in how it watches the cities from here forward, because as that review process occurs over and over, it's not just a one-time through. We're going to be now in a constant process of that, and we hope that we can make sure that that continues. Historically, it's been a staffing problem for them to be able to do that. Through periodic review and those things, it's been very difficult for them to keep up with the load. We think the urban service agreement portions of this are very helpful, but we'd remind you that we've had requirements for urban services in the law for about 19 or 20 years, and it wasn't exactly a great solution all along, but at least we're bringing it back up again, putting it on the table, and hopefully getting people to think a little further ahead about services. This still doesn't solve some of the urban service problems we face throughout the state in terms of making sure that when things are brought into an urban growth boundary, that they're then brought into a city and developed. And we do, obviously support the fact that this will go to moving it to LUBA for the decisions. We think that's really going to be helpful.
You almost said the word annexation there. Okay. Yeah. I liked your two reaction while we talked about the urban service agreements. Let's hear from you. Aaron.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, again, Aaron Doyle with the League of Cities. We testified in the first public hearing knowing pretty much what this dash one was going to look like, because we've been very heavily involved in the very collaborative process that has taken people you would never expect to see at the same table, let alone agreeing on a particular issue related to land use, coming to consensus and having very open and honest discussions about the current concerns and problems in the land use system. And we're very excited to be part of that process, because the UGB system as it stands has become incredibly overbearing and difficult to get through for cities, particularly our smaller cities. And that's why that separation between cities over 10,000 and under 10,000 is so vitally important, and the burdens that are placed on those larger cities are slightly increased as an offset, because they will have more capacity to do more in-depth looks at their redevelopment and their infill, and we recognize that it's an important process of keeping up with efficient use of land. But we also think this will be a way of efficiently using our resources to appropriately house and employ the folks who want to live in cities, which currently sits at around 70% of Oregonians and will increase in the next 10 years to about 76%. Mark and I are sitting here next to each other together on urban service agreements, which is not something you will probably ever hear me say ever again. this was an important part of the compromise and the discussion that took place at the table, and I think that this is the give and take, and it will help get these urban service agreements that maybe aren't completed done. It was important to have both a requirement that we get them done, but also a process by which we could get them done, and this bill provides that for both cities and special districts who are looking at this issue and trying to find a way through. And Finally, I also want to echo the thank yous both to the governor's office and to the department and to all of the folks that sat at the table for more hours than I was there, and I was there for a lot of hours. So I think it has been an incredibly useful process, and a lot of discussion has been done, and I hope that carries forward through the rulemaking process where we can reach the final wording on everything. But this is a great direction and a good start. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. At the outset, I'd just simply like to thank Mr. Whitman, Mr. Rue, the staff at DLCD, and Ms. Doyle. This has been a long, long conversation, and quite frankly, the special districts had only one issue of interest, and that is contained in Section 6 of the -1 Amendment, very small part of a much larger package. During the previous hearing, I described the importance of urban services agreements, and I'm happy to say that with the help of Mr. Whitman and the department, we have come to an agreement on how urban services will move forward in a very small part of this bill. For those cities over 10,000 who are using an expedited urban growth boundary expansion process. It would be negligent of me not to mention that there are a lot of areas that still won't be required to have urban services agreements under this bill. And I'm sure Aaron and I will have future discussions about that quandary and hope to meet some type of a consensus that we can bring to you at some future date. I would note just a few details that were left out of Section 6, and Mr. Whitman had mentioned one of those about a second notification by certified mail. There were just a couple of other issues that were also left out of the amendment. I think that they can either be fixed either statutorily or through rules, but just to get those on the record, the first is that a district that does not want to enter an urban services agreement ought to let the city know in writing that they are not interested in pursuing an urban services agreement. The other item that I had just thought of that I don't know if we had ever contemplated were those instances where a city and a district already have an urban services agreement and the district is satisfied with the urban services agreement that is in place and what would happen in that case. I think it's something that we can probably, again, work through rule. But with that said, we're happy to support the -1 amendment, either with the understanding that those concerns will be addressed either with a further an amendment or through rulemaking process. And I thank you and would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions? Representative Holby.
Thanks, and this is probably the perfect panel to answer. This really looks like a lot of great work, and you know, just looking through this -1 really, you know, I guess shows us that there has been a lot of good work in it. And I'm not sure if this has already been addressed or it's addressed somewhere in the amendment, but I'm kind of curious about the issue around buildable lands and you know how that relates to land being serviceable. The definition of buildable lands doesn't necessarily mean it has to be in an urban growth boundary the way I'm looking at the bill. It just is in an urban or urbanized area and that are suitable for urban uses, but I'm but notwithstanding that, the answer to that question, the other question is does this really address what happens to the land that we can't, that are inside these urbanized areas that are not able to have a service agreement or that we can't provide the services that are needed to make it actually buildable, yet it's still being counted as, I want to know if it's, are we addressing that as still being buildable land, or is it not buildable land for the purposes of, you know, expanding your urban growth boundaries? Because I think that there's always been a little bit of a disconnect there from my standpoint. So does this -1 amendment
address that disconnect?
For the record, again, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor, Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, yes, it does address it. In the materials that you have, there's a very colorful map that identifies what we mean by urban and urbanizable land, and I'll just try to talk you through that very quickly. Urban land is land that is within an urban growth boundary that has an urban level plan and actually zoning designation. And then urbanizable land is land within an urban growth boundary, but it still has a rural zoning designation. So in terms of, I'm getting to your question, don't worry. In terms of
Well, that was part of the question, I guess.
In terms of buildable land, we're talking about land within the urban growth boundary that can be either urban or urbanizable, but it has to be within the urban growth boundary. And we only count land as buildable, you know, if it's not excluded because of hazards or other issues. But the more important point is going forward, there are very strong provisions in this legislation, and Mr. Bush referred to them, that assures that land that does come in through this new process can actually be built upon. That's one of the key provisions of the bill, is a much closer look at the lands coming in to make sure that they actually can be built on. So there are criteria in the locational part of the statute that do that. In terms of agreements and who provides the services, that's the purpose of this new section that requires that either there be an agreement between the city and the appropriate district about who's going to be providing the service, or if the district doesn't want to have an agreement, essentially it's an agreement not to have an agreement, and the city will have the ability to withdraw that land area from the territory of the district in that case and provide the service.
Tara Klein, Representative Holvey, just a follow-up. I think there is a requirement when we do the prioritization of the land now to look at the practicability, I was hoping to avoid that word, of servicing the area as well. And if an area of land is too rocky, too steep to provide that water and sewer to, we have to take a look at that at the very beginning and not consider that land as part of an expansion of our UGB or an area within the UGB. So I think that that helps connect the concept of providing services to a land, to the land, and having a buildable land supply. And it's something that now under this, the cities will have to be very aware of when they're making their decision. And that's part of the trade-off of having this streamlined system, is also to have a really conscious thought process about what land, what services, what extensions can be afforded to provide those services to those lands.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, follow up.
And so I see that as new lands are being brought in, that they're going to be buildable. What about the existing lands that are already in the UGB that are, for some lack of services, are you can't build on them? Yet today I think they're being counted as buildable land supply. Are they going to be continued to be counted as buildable land supply?
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, yes, they will be continue to be counted as part of the buildable land supply, but again, there are provisions in the statute and there will be in the rules that allow, if not require, the local government to take those constraints into consideration in terms of what the actual realistic development capacity of those lands is over time. So they may be part of the buildable land supply, but the amount of development that is assumed to occur on them may be lower because of those constraints.
Thanks. Let me just make sure I've got something. You scared me there for a moment. When you talked about in a situation where they're not able to reach an agreement, and I think this is on page 13, line 19, the special district chooses not to negotiate an urban service agreement or does not respond to the notice, the city may withdraw from the service territory
service territory of the district, any portion of the study area that is included within the urban growth boundary and annexed to the city. So this is only places that are already annexed to the city. No new withdrawal powers to, or no new types of annexation are being created. These are areas that are already annexed to the city but are just in a special district.
Chair Klein, that we can't suddenly annex with new power under this. That is specific to the situation where when a special district decides it doesn't want to enter into negotiations on an urban service agreement. Mm-hmm. Because of the teeth behind this provision is that we are not allowed to withdraw territory from the special district after annexation. Until we have an urban service agreement in place, but if the special district failed or did not want to negotiate, we would then be prevented without that provision from withdrawing the territory from the service district, but we'd still have to follow any one of the current annexation rules and regulations.
It's written a little strange. I understand what you just verbally said, mm-hmm. but it says the city may withdraw from the service territory of the district any portion of the study area that is included within the urban growth boundary of the city and annexed to the city. So it sounds like it already has to be annexed to the city. The way that's written sounds like it already has to be within the UGB and annexed to the city, otherwise it can't be withdrawn.
Terrifying, that's correct. You have to have annexed the city in order, annexed the territory into the city's incorporated boundaries
prior to that's what I was getting at.
And that's the standard now and remain the standard. But it's just a drafting issue.
Yeah.
Chair Clem, Mark Landauer for the record. If you also refer to line 30 on page 14, subsection 10 of section 6, you'll note that a city may not withdraw territory from a service the service territory of a district unless A or B are met on the top of page 15. That's really, I think, the critical issue from the withdrawal perspective. I know that you're very concerned about annexation.
And withdrawals.
Subsection 10 of section 6 is really the teeth, if you will, of that entire section.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for... All right. Thank you. We really want to try and get to that next bill. So, Mary Kyle again, please.
And then
Davis had 12 questions about subsections.
The chair may cut me off on my yields. But
and then Damian, you're going to again be our last speaker here.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Chair Clem, members of the committee, Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I'm just going to touch on a few items in our written testimony. I want to emphasize again that for House Bill 2254, it has come to you because there was, again, a diverse advisory group that met for over a year and a half, weekly at times, doing a lot of diligent work over long hours to test the various aspects of this bill, and at many times we thought we would not get to a consensus because of unintended consequences, data issues, that sort of thing. But we have eventually reached a point where all of us believe that we are confident that the framework established in this bill for rulemaking by LCDC will lead to the objectives that the advisory group started with and that you've heard Richard Whitman describe. And just to emphasize a few of the points that you've heard already, one of the primary aspects of the bill which we support is that it focuses on ensuring that cities ensure that the land that's inside the urban growth boundaries is provided with infrastructure. That hasn't been emphasized enough in our current land use program. The land use program plans for infrastructure, but it's not tied very well to actually seeing that it's provided. And as you heard Drake Butch mention, that's a real key and part of the and one of the reasons why the home builders are supporting this bill, and we agree with that also. Job growth and residential growth in every community in Oregon has occurred overwhelmingly where that land is already supplied with infrastructure or it realistically will be. I think I'll end there because you have a lot of other people waiting to testify in the next bill. So thank you. We support 2254-1.
Very kind of you. Damian.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity again to testify remotely. This is Damian Cernick. I'm a senior planner with the City of Bend. I'm here today to testify in support of the proposed Dash 1 amendments on House Bill 2254. I also wanted to remind you that I provided written testimony on the original concept back at your March hearing, and I just wanted to highlight a couple of the important things, reasons for why I'm supporting the concept. One is the work that Aaron and Mark did on incorporating the key concepts from House Bill 2256. I think this is going to be a real benefit for local governments and will streamline the process that cities and districts can use for developing urban service agreements. I also wanted to support the section where LUBA will not have jurisdiction to review these decisions made under this bill. And also wanted to highlight that this is a bill that still requires a lot of work. I think it provides good direction for LCDC and rulemaking. And on a point we haven't talked about yet, there's while the bill focuses a lot on land, meeting land need, and infrastructure, one of the things that's still going to be required of cities that are over 25,000 in population like Bend is the work under ORS 197-296 regarding needed housing. So that hasn't gone away, and it will still be something we need to address when using a process like this for evaluating our urban growth boundary. So that concludes my testimony. I would recommend and support passing the final amendments onto the House with a recommendation of due pass. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Thanks, Damian. Probably going to, again, we've got the paperwork. We're probably going to hold off and do this one and the other one together on Tuesday. But thank you. Any questions? Okay. All right. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2254. Okay, let's open our public hearing on House Bill 2255. Now, while Mr. Whitman joins us, I just need to ask, because there's a lot of few blanks. We got to find if there's other anyone at all actually in support of this. Okay, that, so you meant to mark that box. Thank you. And Damian, are you a supporter of this one?
Yes, I am.
Okay, that's good. I'm just going to put you on the support panel because it's not big, so I'm looking for... And then Dick Gordon?
Yes, I am in support.
Oh, okay, we've got our panel. And then everybody else. So, Mr. Whitman.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I know there are people who have come a long way probably to testify about this bill, so I'm going to be very brief on it. There are three parts to House Bill 2255. The general thrust of the bill is to provide additional tools to plan for employment growth in our communities around the state.
Are we talking about any specific amendment right now?
Yes, I'm sorry. Chair Clem, members of the committee, I'm here to testify to House Bill 2255-2.
Okay.
So House Bill 2255-2 contains three new tools for communities to use to plan for employment growth. First of all, and I'll draw your attention to this chart, which should be hopefully in your electronic materials.
I don't
use this one's fairly electronic. Simple compared to some of the things I've thrown at you.
Sure. I'm the only one who doesn't really use the electronics, so I'll find it eventually.
Okay.
I'm the one computer guy here. A little bit strange.
And so the three tools, very briefly, are industrial. Yes, that's it, Chair Clem. Industrial reserves, employment opportunities of state significance, and employment opportunities of regional significance. And I'm going to talk for just a second about each one. The industrial reserves is very similar to the existing urban reserve program, with a couple of key differences. One, there's somewhat more flexibility in terms of what lands could be included in an industrial reserve. Two, it's a shorter, likely a shorter time period in terms of the amount of lands that can be brought in to an industrial reserve. And three, and most important, the lands, if they are added to an urban growth boundary, have to be used for traded sector industrial use. One of the main criticisms of the reserve program that we've had is that It is when lands have been designated as reserves, it's led to fairly rapid increase in land prices that has caused disinvestment in agriculture in those lands, even though they may not be brought into an urban growth boundary for a long time. We believe that if the use is specific to industrial use, that's a use that has the lowest land value of urban uses. We can hold down that land price speculation and enable agricultural use to really continue for a longer period of time, more true to the original intent of the reserves program. So that's the first tool. The second tool, which is the one that I think is the one that's become most controversial, is employment opportunities of state significance. This would allow, and again, this is a local option, both the city and the county would have to agree to this, but if they do, and there is an opportunity with an employer who is willing to commit by agreement to provide 500 or more jobs to add land through an expedited process to an urban growth boundary within a 180-day period. There are additional sideboards. In addition to having to agree to 500-plus jobs and having to be adjacent to the existing urban growth boundary, you have to show there's no existing site within the urban growth boundary available for this use, and that the required site is at least 150 acres. And again, the use has to be traded sector industrial. We've done some quick research to see how many companies have moved to the state of Oregon since 1990 with 500 or more employees. And the sources of data for this are somewhat inexact. It's hard to get exact employment information, but our data show that there are 9 companies that have moved to the state of Oregon since 1990 with 500 or more employees that are in the traded sector industrial category. We haven't looked at the acreage that the site that those companies have required, but once you apply that screen, 150 acres or more, that list of 9 we are pretty sure is going to drop significantly from 9. Probably to 2 or 3. So this is really a tool to be used in exceptional circumstances where we have an employment opportunity of real significance to the state of Oregon, and we have certainty that those jobs are actually going to be provided. I know this is controversial, but I think people are presuming that this is going to be used with much more frequency than our data show that it is likely to be used. The last tool I'll only spend a second on, this is really responsive to the issue that Representative Bentz testified to at the beginning of the day today, Eastern Oregon. It's the same idea as the state significance tool, but with a lower employment number and a lower acreage number, responding to the reality that in Eastern Oregon, you're not going to get an employer. Getting an employer with 500 or more is going to be almost unheard of. So we've dropped the employment number to 100 and the acreage number to 50. The last point I'll make is that there are quite a few industrial sites of 50 acres or more that have been planned in Eastern Oregon, including for the city of Ontario, as well as other cities in Malheur County. So I know Representative Bentz feels that the existing system is not working. We believe actually the system has worked pretty well in that part of the state. We understand his point that we do seem to be losing opportunities to the state of Idaho. That's why we're willing to work on some new, if there are problems, on some new tools to address those issues. But I think we have some disagreements with both sides of this debate in terms of how much it would be used and how much it's needed. So I'll close there and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Davis, or Representative Davis, sorry.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Richard. The primary concern that I've seen raised over this bill is we don't need it. There's enough. industrial land. So could you talk about the requirement under the second and third opportunities in the bill that no existing site within the UGB is available?
Again, Chair Clem, Representative Davis, it's actually not just that there not be another site within the urban growth boundary. It's actually within a five-mile radius for the second tool, recognizing that there are already under existing law, if you have an existing rural industrial operation, that can be used for new industrial development also. And also abandoned mill sites mm-hmm. can be used mm-hmm. for industrial development. Those decisions were made by the legislature back in our last recession in 2003. So you would have to show not just is there not a site within the urban growth boundary, but also within a radius of where you want to locate, that really this is the only place. So again, we believe that that's going to limit this to situations where our land use system really isn't working and where there really is a need to provide industrial land to meet an opportunity.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. So it seems to me like we have a system that does not respond quickly to opportunities that aren't within the planned system. I mean, part of having a centralized planning government is that there will be opportunities that come along that we didn't plan for. That's sort of the point. So is the intent here that this become a pressure relief valve in those rare circumstances where we haven't planned correctly?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, that's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay, Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair Clem. And then so kind of following up on Representative Davis's line of questioning, do we really need a pressure relief valve? Is there an example that where there has been an industry that wants to bring 500 jobs with 150 acres or more land that couldn't get sited here? And I think of the special session that we had to make sure that we didn't lose a business that was going to bring a third of those number of jobs into the area. It just seems like we already have processes to deal with these special circumstances. Why create a new process to deal with something that we've already proven, even in the most extraordinary circumstance, we've made it happen? Mm-hmm. So I'd be curious to know where the problem really is.
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, a good question. I don't know the specifics, but there have been allegations in the past that there have been some large prospective employers that have gone to other states because we didn't have a suitable, very large site here in Oregon. And as a proponent of our land use system, part of the purpose of this bill is to frankly take away that criticism of our system that it is a planning system. We do work very hard to try to set up in advance where we're going to grow, but also recognizing that part of having a planning system is, you know, from time to time there will be occasions that you can't anticipate, and that's what this bill is intended to address. We do not expect it to be used often. There is a provision in the bill that limits how often it could be used to no more than twice in a two-year period. But frankly, looking at the data from 1990 forward, I would be surprised if this was used twice in a 10 or 15-year period.
In follow-up, thank you, Chair. Is there a process right now that the state and the land use process could use to create these kinds of exceptions if needed for opportunities like this?
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, there are existing ways of both trying to anticipate. The urban reserves are one of those tools. But you can do a plan amendment and an urban growth boundary amendment. This is a way of doing that fast, much faster than it would normally take.
Representative Davis.
Thanks, Chair. I appreciate Representative Unger's question. It seems to me that one of the problems, though, is that if we do have sort of a fish on the hook, one might say, we don't want to have to come back into a special session to fix a system that isn't working. It's good to have something that exercises local control, where a local jurisdiction and county can respond to that. We don't have to go to the legislature and supersite something for a single entity. But do you think that's accurate?
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, the threshold requirement that the city and county agree to use this is intended to make sure that it is a tool that's only used where the local elected officials want to use it. So, and it is designed so that we don't have to do something extraordinary like we did recently. So, yes.
Okay, any further questions for Mr. Whitman? Okay, great. Trying to recall if I actually ever opened a public hearing on House Bill 2255. Okay. Good.
They can come and do it again.
Yeah, I had to do that the other day. Okay, Robert, actually, can I just ask, on this list, nobody is listing themselves as over 100 miles from here. Is there somebody who is over 100 miles besides on the phone? It doesn't count. Okay, good. I'm just going to go in order then. Robert Bailey and Kathleen Carl and Diane Mickelson, please. And while you're walking up, Barton, are you a yes or a maybe?
I'm a maybe.
Okay. All right. I'm just going to take you in order then.
Chair Clem, Vice President Cameron, and members of the committee, good afternoon. I am Robert Bailey. I am a board member of Save Helvetia, a farmland preservation organization in northwestern Washington County. We have made our case for preserving our area farmland, and it's available through citizen science and testimony on our website that's on the testimony that you'll receive. We presented our reserves appeal to the State Court of Appeals this January and await their ruling. We recently marked the 100th anniversary of Tom McCall's birth, and we appear very quickly here to be adding or subtracting to the Oregon story that he contributed to. We do not read House Bill 2255 as a chapter that belongs in that story. The postmortem of the Metro Urban Reserve process is not yet complete, and we think it's premature not to have the lessons learned that will come from the appeals court ruling. We recognize that cities and counties have substantial conflict of interest with increased tax base and may not also be well qualified to undertake the comprehensive analysis expected. We experienced some of the state departments, including the Department of Agriculture, to have substantial expertise to offer in the reserves process we experienced, and we would encourage them not being omitted. Once land speculation begins, land prices escalate, and this prevents land returning to agriculture. We have a lot of example of noxious weed parcels north of Hillsboro that have gone unused, and it makes farming in adjacent lands all the more complicated, especially when their seed crop purities are needed at 99.9%. We've seen Hillsboro leapfrog across already designated industrial land to get to land that is less parcelized, making it easier for them to aggregate, but it creates islands of land that becomes more difficult to farm. The infrastructure costs going up. Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, thank you. I just want to make sure I've got something right. We were just consulting it. You're really not talking about the base bill moving the 20-year period from 20 down to 14 years. You're talking about these amendments that were just described by Mr. Whitman, I think.
Well, I'm addressing the base bill. I haven't seen the amended bill.
So the base bill, I just want to make sure we're on the same page because I think you'd like this one. That's moving the planning period for buildable supply purposes from 20 years down to 14 years, meaning we'd have less pressure to go out because we're not having to plan for as many years worth of land inside the UGB.
The process we just went through had a 40-year horizon.
Okay. So you don't like the base bill either, just the planning period reduction?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry.
I also want to point out that during our reserves process, citizens asked formally at a joint hearing of Metro and Washington County why they weren't abiding by public meeting laws. And they responded that they thought they were responding to a legislative mandate and thereby were not obliged to public meeting laws. Whatever you do with this bill, we would like it to be transparent and open to the public meeting laws. We also, in Washington County, believe we received short shrift on citizen involvement by Washington County and Metro, and we were delegated to rollouts of predetermined plans that came from back rooms. And we notice in this bill there's some subtraction from citizen involvement with limited grounds of appeal and review, minimum hearing process, and more restrictive notice. We also noticed in our reserves process that there was a lot of temptation put on the table with land speculation and values due to go up markedly. We experienced some elected officials, deciders, not making declarations of possible conflict of interest, and there were no extraordinary conflict of interest expectations in the reserves legislation. In this bill.
One moment again. Sorry, yeah. I misspoke earlier. I'm sorry. There's some of these other items are in the base bill, and sorry about that. I didn't mean to confuse you. Everything you're talking about is appropriate, though. If you could, I understand for history purposes the reserves are really troubling to you. If you could keep it to this bill mostly just in the sake of time so we can get to some other folks.
Well, I see this subtracting even further from citizen involvement protections. We also say that you're putting extraordinary temptation on the table with land speculation and encourage, based on our recent history, expectations that would restrict and constrain those possible conflicts. We think Tualatin Valley soils are more irreplaceable than the old growth fir that has been taken out of Oregon. You know, once you take it out, it's gone forever.
Okay. Thank you for coming down.
Chairman Clinton, my name is Catherine Carl, and I'm testifying in opposition to this, and I'm part of a farm family in Hubbard, Oregon. First, one problem is that this bill allows cities to expand even faster on farmland. It does not require them to first use partially developed lands and then go on to farm and forest land last. It reverses it. So, in fact, forest lands aren't even protected. So the current law is not a barrier to using farmland. I mean, I've testified before many towns wanting to expand. And when you're doing, when Representative Davis was talking about local control, when it's local control, people want to protect their farms as well as the cities need to provide jobs. So currently, cities, every city that expands its urban growth boundary in the Willamette Valley includes some farmlands. And currently, cities can already designate these urban reserves for a period of 10 to 30 years beyond the current UGB. This bill, however, removes the order so that you're going on to best farm and forest land before you had to go on to those last. And it doesn't say that you have to go on this last. Cities are supposed to, under this bill, avoid lands that are suitable for sustaining long-term agriculture operations. Yeah, my own experience with the city of Woodburn was that the same person working for the city to put together an industrial UGB expansion was also working for a developer of a large piece of wonderful farmland. I think that the current laws give an overall statewide fairness, and that this bill even ignores the Department of Agriculture and Oregon Department of Forestry. They have the expertise and the motivation, that's important to me, to protect our resource that the cities do not have. A second big problem is the supersiting, which can occur on any land. regardless of its value for farming, forestry, or natural resources. This is the antithesis of why the land use laws were established. This is the antithesis of what farmers need. I'd like to quote from the Oregon Farm Bureau policy book. I'm not here as a Farm Bureau member. I'm just quoting from it on superseding. We oppose the superseding of any non-farm activity that would subtract from or adversely affect the surrounding agricultural industry and resource base. And under both the superseding and especially industrial reserves, cities can more easily change the industrial designation if the jobs do not appear. That is a big fear of mine. Gee, it didn't work out. We can't find the industry. Let's change it. Let's change it to commercial. Let's change it to residential. In my county, Marin County, agriculture is the number one industry. 20 to 25% of jobs in Yamhill, Polk, and Marin County are created by agriculture and ag-related businesses. Let us not throw that beauty, let us not throw that income away with unneeded loss. That's all.
Thank you. I'm Diane Michelson, and I am testifying in opposition to House Bill 2255. I live in the city of Woodburn, but our family farm is on property that is between Woodburn and St. Paul, so we're west of Woodburn. Not too long ago, I was in a meeting of the LCDC and listened to a presentation by a member of the governor-appointed task force to explore ways to meet the carbon reduction goals set by the state. When asked by a commissioner what the DLCD could do to help, the gentleman replied, "Freeze urban growth boundaries." He then went on to explain that compact cities can provide necessary services at much less cost, both financially and environmentally. Sadly, he was not listened to. What will happen if a city puts more land in its UGB and urban reserve that it can possibly develop? The city of Kaiser has zoned much of the land along the Salem-Kaiser Parkway industrial, but because of a significant change in circumstances, it became a commercial development and is now just another pedestrian-unfriendly shopping center. Whether this was the correct decision or not is not the point. The point is, if you designate more industrial land than you can develop, pressure grows from landowners and from developers to change the designation. And the land that was supposed to provide good jobs only provided basic minimum wage retail jobs with few or no benefits. Investing in businesses that are already within the UGB or small businesses which want to grow is a far better use of dollars and services. In fact, most job growth occurs from just these types of businesses, not the mega employers who come to an area, milk it for all the profits they can get, and then leave for a cheaper area. The city is then stuck with vacant industrial capacity. While the land may eventually be converted to other uses, it is extraordinarily unlikely that it will be converted back to farmland. And there's also a loss of tax revenue when these big companies go away. This bill also constrains citizen involvement and judicial review. Written notices of hearings are only provided to farmers if they live 500 feet from the proposed property change. Well, I'll edit here. The bill also removes LUBA from the appeals process and tells the Oregon Court of Appeals that what criteria it can use for judicial review and limits citizens' grounds for appeal. But while LUBA has been removed from superseding appeal, decisions would now be taken to the Economic Recovery Review Council. With the name Economic Recovery, it is doubtful that any activity which does not involve paving will receive an objective review. Goal one of Oregon's land use system is supposed to be citizen involvement. That goal will be rendered meaningless by HB 2255. This past summer, our family toured areas of Washington County which had been placed in urban reserves. There was much farmland in these reserves, so the current system certainly does not constrain cities from including farmland in urban reserves. However, there was a public process in which many individuals and groups representing a wide variety of interests participated. HB 2255 tries to go around this process by the tantalizing prospect of jobs without any evidence that such jobs will arrive. If they do arrive, that they will stay more than 5 years. It is probably cheaper for the company to pay the pathetically small fine and leave than to abide by their 5-year 500 jobs requirement. Oregon's land use system has been around for 40 years and has evolved over that time. Oregonians going to the polls have supported their land use system. Please do not allow this chipping away of our system one bill at a time. Please defeat Measure 2255.
Okay, thank you. And Tony Holt, Peggy Lynch, and David Engen. I will note while you're walking up, the Economic Recovery Council is a pre-existing body, not created under this bill. I was the chief sponsor of the bill that created it. It's on another topic, but we're hooking it up in this bill, I believe. So, not to malign them unnecessarily here, if we could, but okay.
Okay.
Roger, you want to fill in here since David and Casey seem to... A lot of my constituents here, I notice, opposed to this. That's great. Okay, come on up.
Okay. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Tony Holt, and I represent a large group of homeowners who live at the southern end of the Metro Urban Growth Boundary, and therefore the northern end of the Willamette Valley prime agricultural land. It seems to us that I repeat what was said just before I came up here. It seems to us that this bill would overturn 40 years of very careful, hard-fought land use discussions, which have culminated in Oregon's land use laws, which are the envy, I think, of many states in this country. Our concern is this bill will lead to a replacement of the prime Willamette Valley ag land with industrial sprawl. The bill pays no heed to the key question: where on earth is the infrastructure going to come from when you place these industrial reserves and supersiting in the middle of outside the urban growth boundary? And it also seems to throw out all the checks and balances that we're used to on when we look at growth. And finally, it ignores the fact that many of the cities, and particularly the city that I live in, within the metro urban growth boundary, already have industrial land with infrastructure, some infrastructure in place, and are looking for people to come and develop on that land. And this seems to me to basically overstep that and go into the area outside the urban growth boundary. We don't take much comfort in the fact that it's been stated that this won't be used very often, and therefore I would ask the committee to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I reserved my 2253 and 2254 time for this. We oppose 2255 as presented and as the latest amendments that we have seen, and I understand there are even more to come. And there are a number of reasons, and you've heard lots of concerns. I do want to focus on just one area. The most egregious is the use of that Senate Bill 766 from 2011 as a process for adding industrial land that is not currently zoned industrial. The promise of 766 was to provide an efficient permitting process of land that the community had determined in a prior land use process to be industrial land. The rigorous public process had already occurred, and that was the key to the passage of 766. 2255 now attempts to use this process for lands that the community has not already designated as industrial, nor has had a full and complete public conversation regarding the proposed land under 2255. We believe this is a violation of the concept of our statewide planning program with local implementation. Unelected state agency officials are not the same as a decision by local elected officials made after the appropriate Goal 1 public engagement. And I will share with you a couple of pieces of information. Under Senate Bill 766, a city or a county can act by resolution that they would like to participate. By resolution means that it may show up on somebody's agenda, but it doesn't mean a public hearing because they don't have to have with a resolution, and there's not necessarily any more notice than what might show up in the newspaper. And I know this because I actually was probably the only public person who followed the 766 process as it was used with Goshen and the three Douglas County sites. I was the only public person at the hearings, one of which was had each of the agencies say something. The second hearing took 5 minutes to, as a matter of fact, I tried to do it by phone and almost missed the decision. So it's not an open public process. And I want to make something really clear. 2254 provides for employment land opportunities. We know that. We are not against jobs. We believe that jobs pay taxes and taxes pay for services, and we need services in the state of Oregon. We get the nexus. We just think this is the wrong bill and the wrong way to go about it. Thank you for listening.
Good afternoon, Representative Clem, Chair Clem, Vice Chair Cameron, and members of the committee. My name is Roger Kay. I'm current president of Friends of Marion County, P.O. Box 3274, Salem, Oregon. Friends of Marion County is a nonprofit 501c3 membership organization established in 1998 to protect farm and forest lands in Marion County. We oppose HB 2255 in order to protect the farmland resource we have and ask that you vote no. Marion County's number one industry is farming, and farmland resources are dwindling each year. House Bill 2255 has the opposite effect, that is, it further diminishes the farmland base that protects growers, processors, and consumers from non-agricultural industrial sector. Former Governor Kulongoski agreed to the establishment of the Mill Creek Industrial Park in the city of Salem. The former state prison farm property consisted of more than 650 acres, is within the city limits and close to Interstate 5 and State Highway 22. Right now, the site is occupied by several private and county operations, while much of the land remains unoccupied. If HB 2255 passes, the City of Salem can't ignore this site and guide other industries to sites with a greater impact on farmland along the Interstate 5 corridor. The recent news that NORPAC is developing a large cold storage facility on Majona Avenue in Salem is encouraging. This is a company whose life is dependent on large parcel and productive farmland, yet they did not require expansion of Salem's UGB. There is an abundance of industrial parcels within the current UGBs of cities. Creating larger UGBs is not the answer to promote job growth, increasing educational opportunities, job training, and research and development will be more effective. And that's my written testimony, but one more thing I want to add. The work group met for many, many months. Mr. Whitman talked about that process. I entered as an observer probably halfway through and watched all the stakeholders participate in that work group. They had subcommittees. They did a pretty good job. Right at the end of that work group meeting process, this supersiding measure was mentioned. There was very little input from stakeholders, and it really didn't pop up till the last moment. And I think what you're looking at is a bill that was generated out of Whitman, Mr. Whitman's office, and did not have the broad consensus of approval by all the stakeholders that you're seeing in the previous bill. Thank you.
Okay, so just Peggy, hold tight for 1 second. The other two are free to go. Just so folks know, we're at 5 o'clock. Committee members may have to leave, but the room luckily is available because it's 5 o'clock. So I'm going to stay and go through everybody who wants to stay. And two questions. First of all, isn't it nice that we're having a public hearing on amendments that we technically don't have to because we already heard the bill?
Representative, or Chair Clem.
Just between her and I, sorry.
Chair Clem, thank you very much.
Thanks.
The League appreciates this opportunity for the people behind you.
Yes, I know.
To speak.
So here's the one thing I do want you to think about. You know, we talk a lot about public involvement. But what I'm wondering about is this situation where there is, you know, a big fish and everybody involved is covered under a non-disclosure agreement, that's the part where I don't know exactly by its very definition how to get public process into something like that, except to have it now as we're authorizing, you know, something that might happen later. I don't know how you do it, because the very definition of these things seems to be that there's these economic development officials and maybe the governor and some other people who know about it, and then, you know, then the deal is basically done if you've got a place for them to go.
Chair Clem, I do understand the question, and I was a business owner. I get the confidentiality issue. I do understand it. However, I should just say, I remember Nike. It is not the most, we did not necessarily support that process. We didn't like that process. But what I would not like to do is to add a bunch of land that may end up not happening. What would happen with this is if somebody got to add 150 acres, signed the contract, and then walked away, paid their $10,000 per employee, which in a huge company may not be a whole lot of money, and now all of a sudden you have land that a farmer is not likely to want to spend money on for infrastructure for farming because of being jeopardized by the fact that it may, if it gets to revert back to agriculture, but the next time a big fish comes around, you know darn good and well they're going to look right there. So that's the issue. It's that, okay, you have a big fish, figure out a way to deal with it once every 20 or 30 years. I'm very, frankly, I'll tell you the other reason, I'm very worried about big fish. I like little fish, because if one of those little fish goes away, and I'm not saying the Eastern Oregon little fish, but smaller companies.
We call it rural fish.
No, I'm not talking about rural fish. I'm talking about smaller companies.
Yeah.
If a smaller company goes away, you are not crashed like you are when Intel goes away and has before. When they crashed a number of years ago, this state went into recession. And that worries me about a big fish. So I would much prefer that we spend our energies making sure that we have good small and medium-sized companies in this state that provide a wide variety of different kinds of jobs so that we're not dependent like we were years ago on the forestry industry and we don't end up in a disaster again. I'd like a range of economy.
How do you feel about the rural fish portion?
Frankly, if there were a way to do it differently, and I'm interested to hear, I was one of them that asked Director Whitman the question, is there really a need? There's 31,000 people in Malheur County. Aren't 250 acres or 275 acres enough for Ontario to be able to supply employees with? I don't know the rest of the cities, and I ask that we get that information to know whether or not there is a real need. If there is a real need, we need to figure out how to do it. But I don't think we do it by the 766 process that really circumvents the people who live in that area having that conversation.
You mean this new 766 process, not the old one, the Goshen-style one?
Well, the Goshen thing was for land already settled, and it was to allow
them. I mean,
the
existing law you're talking about, don't attach it to this new, don't attach 766 mechanisms to this new.
That's correct.
Rural fish.
We need to if we need to figure out how to deal with, but I do know that Representative Bence is likely to see some increase in solar energy lands, and there are other benefits that I'm seeing in this process for rural Oregon. And I care about rural Oregon. I got lots of relatives in rural Oregon.
Okay. Thank you for staying after class.
Thank you.
Okay. Lee Doze. Oh, no. I'm sorry. Let me switch to a few yeses. There's not a lot of you, so I'm just going to have Anna maybe. If I could get my maybe and Aaron and then Damien and...
just signed up.
Okay. And so, Dick, we're going to have you speak with this group if you're still there.
I'm still here.
In fact, why don't you go first? Thank you for being so patient. Go ahead, Councillor Gordon.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, and especially thank you for allowing me to testify remotely. My name is Dick Gordon. I'm
currently in my second term on the Medford City Council, past president, current vice president of the council. I also served on the governor's Urban Growth Advisory Committee, a very impressive, diverse group, which many have testified today, and I'm really happy to see that occur. I'm not a tech person, but this advisory committee, there's also a smaller group that spent hours basically working out the details, and I deal with mostly concepts. What I'm happy about with 2255, and I have read the amendments, really goes to the fact that we will have an additional new tool that we don't currently have. It looks like it can be a quicker process and a much cheaper process. We need to continually, in the more rural areas in Southern Oregon, I will classify as a more rural area, we need to continually address economic growth, economic development. At the current time, we do not have the ability to be able to respond quick enough under our land use laws to some specific employment opportunities, including larger companies. I obviously know there's a lot of rulemaking that will need to occur, but in fact, this will help us, or could help us, in the recruitment of industry to this rural area. I would hope that the committee would look at this bill favorably and forward to the full House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Councillor Gordon, and maybe our another yes before our maybe.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, once again, for the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Cities. We are very supportive of this bill for the reasons that Councillor Gordon just spoke to, is the concept of having a few more tools to address some real need in areas. The industrial reserves process, I think, is very important for one key reason. It allows long-range planning. It's not about what do we need in the next 14 years. It allows our planners to go and think, what are we going to need 25 years out? Let's designate that area, but designate it so that it's industrial in nature. So that way, the speculation that you might see on some land values doesn't increase because residential land designation in the future will have a better payout in the end. So people are willing to pay higher prices. But using an industrial reserves designation undercuts that market, and I think it's a very important long-term planning tool. The fish, as we're referring to, I think it's very important to note that this requires an employer to want to move here. And one of the things that has been discussed in a lot of different venues is there is a concept that the Oregon land use system is too slow. And having this proposal out there and on the books and available if an employer wants to come in gives employers a sense that Oregon does want us to come in, and they'll accommodate us in a quick manner, in a way that still requires a land use process. There's still consideration of local land use decisions. There's still local buy-in through the council and through the county, through the cities and through the county. And I think those things are very important and are kind of getting lost in this conversation. And we can't just... I think that's important to have that perception from businesses. And like Richard said, I don't foresee this being needing to be used every year. The other important difference, I think, from the 766 process, which is a great tool, is that this is for when we have the employer here now knocking on the door saying, we want to come in. And there are ramifications that are not cheap if they decide not to employ the number of people that they promised to. If they decided to get this land designated through their agreement and then failed to employ a single person, that's $5 million the company pays a year. And I don't think that that's insignificant for any industrial employer. And I think the other thing to consider is that there is this concept of the 5-mile radius that you have to look at. Sites that are similarly, for the same characteristics that might be already in the UGB that are industrial, that 5-mile radius is pretty vague. when you're looking at land use, especially in some areas where, you know, like the city of Salem, if you hit that five-mile radius, you're going to get a huge chunk of comparative land. And if that land's available in the city of Salem and those site characteristics are there, then they can't use this process. They have to go through our traditional processes. So I think that the carve-outs that are there, the requirements of what the business has to present, and the buy-in that has to come in at the local level is really important. And the final point I'd like to make goes back to the earlier conversation about how we can sometimes have a special session. Local or land use decisions are local decisions. They are governed by local processes and are directed at local decision makers to go through that process. And there isn't currently the ability for the state and the legislature to override that by having a special session and just granting the permit. And I think that that's why this is very necessary, because we don't have that statewide ability to make those kind of planning decisions, and we don't want to have those statewide, you know, state superseding is not what we want. We want local decision makers choosing to place these businesses at the edge of their UGB and just expanding that little bit extra, because there are no sites that allow the business to come in anywhere else within 5 miles. And for those reasons, I support this bill, and I hope we can get there.
Thank you, Aaron. I actually want to ask something for those that have testified earlier, too, to hear the answer. We heard a little bit of testimony, you know, this could be anywhere, and I was just trying to confirm the proposal, page 4 of the dash 2 say that it would have to be adjacent to the UGB. Do you know if that's right?
Chair Clem, that's correct. It would have to be adjacent to the UGB. So the site has to not only be dissimilar from the five-mile radius,
right.
It also has to sit right up against the city's UGB, so that there's a relationship between the city and that land, because the UGB expands differently. Maybe we'll get there eventually, but now there's a business that wants to be there now, and it's right there up against our UGB, and that's, so it can't just be placed in the middle of a county that isn't related to some sort of city. It has to be placed by a UGB already.
Thank you. And I ask that because sometimes when these amendments come out, you know, not everybody has time to sit and read these things in the last 24 hours. So, you know, we're not voting on this today by any means, and I want to really get some clarity around what the proposal is over the weekend for folks. And then we'll go on. Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question that was similar to the one you just asked about the land that's adjacent to the UGB. Because I heard in your comments, Aaron, that it would be land that's adjacent and industrial in nature, and one of my concerns is adjacent to the UGB may be in a nice neighborhood, for example. And I see a lot of references to agricultural lands and protections and all sorts of comments about that, but I don't see, except for one little piece that really doesn't make me very comfortable, that any sort of consideration for neighborhood input or something that all of a sudden I've got a home, and next thing I know, I've got a Nike plant adjacent to my property. And so I'm trying to come to grips with how would you make sure that where you cite something like this, adjacent to the UGB, is also similar in nature to the industrial land that you're citing? Because I don't see anything in the bill that gives me a lot of comfort in making sure that happens.
Chair Clem, Representative Colby, I think there are a few ways in which that would happen. One is that most city and county planners would recognize that a residential right next to an industrial is not a compatible use, and therefore would unlikely support such a and which is a requirement under this. So that's one way in which it can be addressed. Also, there is a requirement under under this that the council does have to have at least one public hearing in the neighborhood of where this is going to be placed. So that issue can be raised at that point before the council, and then the council has to consider appropriate design criteria, the standards of the local permitting agencies, and the standards that cities and counties would normally enforce in those areas when making the final permitting decision. Therefore, if there is a compatibility problem because of a residential neighborhood that would be affected by that planting and industrial use right next to it, I think that then the council would then have to say this is just not an appropriate use there, because they have to do it based on those local permitting standards.
I don't have a follow-up. I'm not sure I'm quite comfortable with it yet, but
quick question
along these same lines.
Are you done? Can I follow up on that question?
Go ahead.
Representative Unger.
It's yours.
Thank you, Chair. Following up on Representative Holvey's questions, would there be an opportunity for local residents to appeal if they didn't like any of the decisions that were made at the by the council?
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, I believe there is an appeal to the courts that they can make.
To LUBA or to the...
If they...
Please, yeah.
Sorry. I'm going to have the DLCD field this one.
Good evening, I guess I should say. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Carrie McLaren, Deputy Director at the Department of Land Conservation and Development. If you turn to page 8 of the -2 amendments, I'm looking at line 9, subsection 14, basically provides the ability for a person who participated in the proceedings before the council to appeal that final order to the Court of Appeals. So, yes, there is, and there is an appeal process. It would receive expedited review, again, fitting within the framework that we're trying to make these decisions quickly.
But further, if you keep on reading here, it says that the... Can I follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
That the council, they only can reverse or remand if the council's, it's a pretty narrow criteria here for appeal. So it's not similar to the appeal process that we have currently under the land use laws.
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, you're correct. There is a more narrow, and I would say a significantly more narrow standard of review for the Court of Appeals.
I would also say significantly more narrow. Thank you,
Representative Holvey.
Thank you. Chair Clem. So back to my issue in this particular scenario of trying to make sure that the industrial siting is, let's say, compatible with the adjacent uses in the UGB where it gets sited. Is there anything that gives us some criteria about what is compatible and what is not? Because if there isn't, you know, the decision by the to site a building in an incompatible area really doesn't have any standing to be overturned by the Court of Appeals, I don't think. And I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I don't see any, you know, anything that gives me comfort with Aaron's, you know, proposal that, you know, it's going to be in a similar industrial by nature area.
Chair Clem, Representative Holvey, I'll try to answer this question briefly, and then if the committee would like, I wouldn't mind if we want to, you know, we can walk through. We did provide sort of a section-by-section analysis, but if this is a particular area of concern for the committee, we'd be happy to put together sort of some supplemental work on that. I would read two sections together. On page 5, on line 21, sort of subsection D, it requires the council to apply the standards and criteria for each local permit, including the standards and criteria for an amendment of the urban growth boundary. And then you flip back again to the review criteria on, well, I didn't flip back, to the right section, but on page 8. And, you know, the standard of review is clearly in error, but there are cases, I'm thinking specifically of siting standards for buffer areas, say, between residential and industrial areas, which are pretty clear and objective in many cases to apply 100-foot setbacks, 200-foot setbacks, et cetera. Those types of things that are in clear air, there would be an opportunity under the standard of review here for that to be a basis before the Court of Appeals. But it is a more narrow standard of review.
Can I ask one last question, Aaron?
Yeah.
Aaron, thank you, Chair Clem. Can you think of any times when not having available industrial land has caused a business of this size to not choose to be located in Oregon?
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, I'm not personally aware of them. I've read the reports, which are always generic in nature. You know, if you look at what's been done on some of the Portland Business Alliance on those industrial readiness bills, they discuss that, you know, sometimes it's not a siting opportunity that gets missed when someone makes the inquiry. The answer can't be immediately, yes, I have a piece of property that you would love. It's the 150 acres that you're going to need, because there just isn't 150 acres altogether due to a lot of reasons, including parcelization or need for remediation, or, you know, there just literally isn't 150 acres together in the current UGB. So I don't know of a specific city, but I can ask my cities to chime in. I might not have come to the city. That's the other thing. Business Oregon might also have a better answer, so I can look for that answer for you.
Thanks.
Okay, let's continue on.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm Barton Brierley, Planning Director for City of Newburgh. The reason I once signed up as maybe is because I really wanted to just talk about the industrial reserves piece. And I really wanted to advocate for that piece. And the last amendments, I think, needed a couple tweaks. But overall, really wanted to support that process. I think it makes sense to keep options open in the long term for industrial land. I think it makes a lot of sense for existing industrial areas to grow over time. I think most existing businesses want to keep their options open to grow. This is really about the existing industrial business being able to buy that 5-acre piece next to them and have some idea that when they need that, that they can, they'll be able to ask that be brought in the urban growth boundary and develop, even if there's not that, you know, short-term need. I think it makes a lot of sense to be able to plan your infrastructure with long-term in mind. Simple decisions about how deep you put the sewer line and how much rock you put in the road make a big difference on, for the next 50 years, how an area can develop. I think it makes a lot of sense for neighborhood planning. The issue Representative Holvey brought up about not wanting the industrial next to the residential area. If you're only planning a short horizon, then you might wake up and saying, oh, the only industrial land options we have next are adjacent to this residential area. So I think it makes sense from a neighborhood standpoint to be able to say, this is going to be our long-term industrial area, and you can plan based on that. I also think it makes sense not only from an economic development standpoint, but from a land conservation standpoint. It preserves the land that's appropriate for industrial use for the long term and makes sure that it's available and committed to that use, and keeps you from having to go to areas that are less appropriate for industrial use. I think it can actually facilitate making smaller urban reserves, because you can focus the land that you need on that those industrial uses. So I think it makes sense in a lot of areas, and really encourage you to adopt the industrial reserves.
Okay. And I think I took Mr. Gordon's already, and Damien's gone. Damien, you're not there, right? Okay, great. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Okay, let's go back to our nose, Lee Doe's. Lee, you're still here. Tom Abrego. And Sid, I know I saw, there he is. Come on up.
Hi,
first on the list? Do you want me to go first?
Lee? However you gentlemen like, but I've got Lee first.
That works for me.
Okay.
Lee Doze, I'm from Newburg, and that would be your district, Representative Thatcher, and thanks for being here tonight. Thanks for allowing me to speak. I'll be brief because I know there's other people behind me. My wife Amy and I own a 20-acre farm about 2 miles from Newburg, and we're 20-year residents here of the state, and I want to make it clear that we moved to Oregon especially because of the land use laws here and the protection that it would offer for the farmland we were looking for. I think this is significant because our other choice with potential was Washington State. And if you look at Washington State now and 20 years ago, you can see what happens to the differences in the land use process. So I would have to say that I'm not in favor of House Bill 2255. It frankly sounds to me like a solution in search of a problem. To be more succinct, I would say, and I would have to say, that I believe our existing land use laws have already proven their worth, again, by limiting that kind of urban sprawl and hopeless congestion that have already taken Washington State up to the north of us. And I also believe it's important that you understand that I'm here on my own nickel. I'm not representing anyone else in particular other than my wife, Dr. Amy, who couldn't be here today. She would love to be here, by the way. She's a doctor of microbiology. She'd be happy to tell you how much safer it is to eat food that is grown, processed, and monitored here in the U.S. versus imported from other countries. There's enough in the news on that. We don't need to go into that.
We like that. Sorry.
So I have attended numerous land use meetings at the city and county level within the Newburg area and Yamhill County. And the reason I'm saying that I'm here on my own is because I think I've already seen too many decisions that I think were preloaded by slanted data from paid consultants with no real skin in the game. And by way of example, and not to pick on anybody in particular, but our own Newburg City Council has just approved its planner's recommendation to bring 200 acres of mostly Class 1 and Class 2 farmland into the Newburg URA. Now, I'm citing this as an example because that land is indeed at the extreme limits of the city, so it's going to require the most tax dollars to fill it in, regardless of where the money comes from. And in particular, the entire process has been driven essentially by an out-of-town landowner's interest in selling off his own land inheritance. And so you can say jobs, jobs, and jobs, but again, this is farmland. Once the farmer is off of that land, he can't go somewhere else. You can cite industry on land that's already reserved, already concrete, etc. And I mention this because Newburg's economy, certainly since the recession began, has been mostly stagnant, in my opinion. And we have empty facilities, and we have vacant resource lands right now that are not being used. And opening up more land through any process at this time is only going to devalue the land that's already there. And more importantly, right now, to my knowledge, if we were to have this particular bill pass, I don't know of a large-scale industrial client that's begging to settle in and reap the benefits of a small, somewhat isolated town with a limited population base available for a large customer. And this is why the whole idea of this super siting, to me, doesn't smell right. It's my understanding that this HB 2255 would also allow land to remain in an urban reserve. Now, I hadn't had a chance to see all the potential amendments, but I find this a little frightening because if that, let's say that that potential client doesn't settle in, doesn't work out, what's to hold the city accountable later on from reapportioning that land as a Walmart, a big box store, whatever? That I find rather troubling, because again, once you move the farmer off the land, that's one property you'll never get back. I know you've heard this argument before. And our current system requires an orderly and predictable approach to expansion. It's one that makes it reliable for the farmer. In my case, I'm not going to invest in my property if someone tells me that 5, 10 years from the road, down the road right now, we're going to close this down. So it doesn't work. So lastly, and for the record, I would say that products from our little 100-year-old farm have been feeding people in the local area now for the entire duration, as far as I can tell, and through several generations of families, not my own. The products may have changed over the years, but public demand for safe and locally grown goods is still there. Throughout our country, we're losing farmland right now at a little over an acre a minute. Oregon has already beaten that record through the laws that we have in place now. We're not losing anywhere near that rate. I'd like to maintain the legacy that Tom McCall set for us. That's all I've got. Any questions, sir?
Nope. Not for me.
Okay, like thank you.
Hood River Valley fruit is very fresh and tasty, just so you know.
I was curious how his wife felt about genetically engineered salmon.
Oh, not Lord.
Okay.
Not in
favor. Banking fish.
I'm a Vice former Chair. Alaska commercial fisherman, sir. Yeah.
Okay.
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Tom Abrego. I'm a private citizen speaking in opposition to HB 2255. I'll be brief and general with my comments. I live in rural Yamhill County near Dundee. I recently retired from a third-generation family nursery located in Marion County, just north of Salem, Kaiser. During my career, I experienced experienced the constant challenges of encroaching urbanization posed to our businesses, challenged our agricultural practices, the safety of our workers, and from our point of view, most importantly, the future growth and expandability of our business. Agriculture is a major contributor to Oregon's economy, particularly, but not limited to our rural areas. As we heard earlier, 23% of agriculture employs 23% of the workers in Yamhill, Marion, and Polk counties. As we've also heard earlier, prime agricultural farmland is one of our most important natural resources, but once it's gone, it's gone. It's irreplaceable. HB 2255 loosens the protections for good agricultural lands across the state. I urge you to stand up and support agriculture by voting against this bill. Thanks.
Chair Clem, committee members. My name is Sid Friedman. I'm the president of Friends of Yamhill County, and I'm representing that organization here today. I'm also speaking as an individual who's worked in various agricultural sectors over the years, and my wife and I currently farm west of Yamhill. Friends of Yamhill County strongly opposes House Bill 2255, including the Dash 2 amendments. The bill threatens our most productive farmland by allowing cities to circumvent the longstanding protections that have made agriculture the number two industry in the state. As you've heard, agriculture indirectly accounts for 23% of the employment in the Mid-Willamette Valley. Looking just at the industrial reserves in the first portion of the bill, cities can already provide for future industrial needs on farmland under existing law. Every urban reserve in state history, including Newburgh's, Metro's, Ontario's, and the recent Rogue Valley Bear Creek cities, has included farmland. What House Bill 2255 would do would greatly weaken the current priorities of land, say farmland last, best farmland, last when you go to farmland, and replace it with a greatly weakened standard of review that cities do not have the expertise, the interest, or the motivation to properly apply those weak agricultural considerations. And the shortage of industrial lands that some cities assert is a problem of their own making. Newburgh has rezoned hundreds of acres of prime industrial land served by rail and highway to retail, commercial, and single-family subdivisions. Kaiser squandered its prime rail-served industrial land at the I-5 interchange on a mega big box center. And both cities now assert that they need even more farmland to replace what they have squandered. Right now as well, a big box developer is producing a new economic opportunities analysis for McMinnville so that it can justify rezoning prime industrial land that is optioned for retail. Now,
Director Whitman said that one of the advantages of the industrial reserves is that the land has to be reserved and used for industrial land. It can't be used for other things. But in fact, the industrial reserve portion of the bill encourages even more bait and switch. Under the bill, if land doesn't develop with industrial uses in a set period of time, cities can rezone it for other uses like big box commercial or cookie cutter subdivisions based on an assertion of, quote, significant change in circumstances. Once the pressure builds up, political, financial, 5 years go by, as quickly as a developer can say, change in significant circumstances, that's how quickly the land will rezone to more valuable uses. Turning to the supersiting for the mega projects, both the 500 jobs portion and the 150 jobs portion, 150 jobs on 5 acres, or 500 jobs on 150 acres, that's a little over 3 jobs per acre. That doesn't seem like a very good deal to me. But more importantly, the bill, these huge projects that would be supersided adjacent to existing UGBs could have tremendous impacts. They could alter the future of a community in many ways. They deserve heightened public involvement, not restricted public notice, reduced public hearings, and very limited appeal opportunities, restricted legal grounds for overturning a decision that's provided for in the bill. I guess I'll echo Peggy here for a moment. A streamlined process may be appropriate for land that is already within an urban growth boundary that's zoned industrial. Planning for those lands has already occurred in a robust public involvement process, and it should be relatively easy to locate industry on that land. But that isn't the case with the huge impact projects that would be supersided outside existing urban growth boundaries. The community deserves a thorough public comprehensive process in determining that it wants something that's going to have a tremendous impact on its future. Under the supersiding provisions in the bill, the public will never have that opportunity. So House Bill 2255 offers an empty promise that more empty land at the urban fringe will grow jobs by attracting new large employers. But the vast majority of new jobs are created by small employers who are already here. Adequate infrastructure and an educated workforce are what really matters, and we should be growing our jobs close in where people already live and where transit is often available instead of out on the fringe. I want to just say one more thing about the supersiding before I close. We've heard some discussion of, well, there's 5 miles, so we're not going to be using it unless there's really no alternative. But 5 miles is nothing. The north end of the Kaiser UGB, north of the stadium, that's more than 5 miles from Mill Creek, the Mill Creek Industrial Park. We could be supersiding on farmland adjacent to Kaiser's UGB on the north end or in Woodburn, even when there's service land already available at Mill Creek, because guess what? The farmland's cheaper for the company that's coming in. So I guess that pretty much does it. I'll urge you to please vote no on House Bill 2255, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Try and get through our list here. Jonathan Manton, Greg Leo, and John Schaefer. Then after that, the only person I know about is Mary Kyle. Fabulous Mary Kyle McCurdy will be in the building, ladies and gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Manton on behalf of Central Oregon Land Watch. I love fishing. I wish I was fishing right now.
Big fish, rural fish, what kind of fish do you like?
Just catching fish would be great right now. So we haven't had a chance to review the language of the amendments yet, and so I'll be very, very brief and just say thank you for giving us the time to do that over the weekend, and we'll get back to you with kind of more official comments. We share a lot of the concerns in general that were raised, especially by Peggy here today as the public process part, but I just ask that we be able to reserve the right to issue more comments after we've had a chance to review the bill. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the Land Use Committee, Greg Leo here today for the City of Wilsonville. First of all, thanks for staying late to hear us. We oppose House Bill 2255. We think it's the wrong solution to the problem. We share the goal of bringing traded sector employment, but as you probably know, we have been involved with the urban rural reserves process now for almost a decade, and we find that we have close to 1,800 acres of land in the triangle between Sherwood, Tualatin, and Wilsonville that we are trying to bring to market. The right solution from our point of view is a bill that you all heard and we testified on before you earlier, House Bills 2284 and 2285, which actually give local government the money in the forgivable loan fund that would actually help us put in the pipes, build the roads, aggregate the properties in a way that can efficiently be developed. And so this particular bill does not help us in our aspirations to develop industrial land. We are dead serious about developing industrial land that helps our traded sector, and we will go about it as best we can, but we don't think this brings much to that party. And specifically, we just want to say that the protection of the large agricultural base in the Northern Willamette Valley is very important to our urban development. Our most recent large company that's moved into Wilsonville is in fact a food processor that trades internationally. So protection of agricultural land in the Northern Marion County area and the development of traded sector industry goes hand in hand. Let's not reduce the job or the land base for agriculture at a time when it has such a dramatic impact on our traded sector industries. So, you know, just you have the four pages of the testimony. I won't burden you any further with that, but I would say let's look at the infrastructure problem before we start looking at ways to bring in new land that we don't have the money to properly develop.
Question for Greg?
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Vice Chair Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Leo. Does the City of Wilsonville have a 150-acre site ready to go today?
Vice Chair Cameron, Chair Clem, yes, we have lands around the Coffee Creek area, about 200 acres that we, when we put in the Coffee Creek prison, we actually right-sized the infrastructure, the sewer and the water, that could go today. The problem with the Coffee Creek area is land aggregation. We have you know, a heavily parcelized area around the prison. So the problem will be to accumulate the land together so it can be properly but yes, it could be done today with the right amount of infrastructure and other aggregation help.
Sir.
Thank you.
Yes, John Schaefer. I live in Dallas, west of here. I want to talk a little bit about Dallas. Dallas is a town of about 15,000. It has three formerly occupied industrial sites within the UGB. Two of them are served by rail, and Dallas is served by two paved highways. One of the sites was occupied by Caterpillar Tractor Company, where they manufactured lift trucks. About 20 years ago, they bailed out for production in Mexico, South Korea, and so on. There is a building that was used to produce printed circuit boards that was purchased by a company back east and then dropped. The operation was moved. And finally, there's a huge building and site used to be occupied by Willamette Industries, which is empty. The point is, echoing Lee, I don't see that there's a whole problem out there of lack of land, lack of sites. These are all sites in the UGB, services, transportation, and they've been advertised for 20 years now, to some extent, at least some of them. So where is the great demand? I don't see blocks of companies circling overhead looking for industrial sites. I think the Nikes and the Hewlett-Packard's and the Intel's are done. They're over. They're not doing that anymore. Jobs are going overseas. China, you name it. India's standing in line. So where is the demand for these 550-acre, 500-employee sites? I don't see it, and I don't see it developing in the future. So that's as much as I want to say. Thank you.
And thank you for sticking with us. Questions for this nice gentleman? Okay, thank you. Lost Katie. Thank you for staying with us to the end.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Members of the committee that are still here, I appreciate it. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends. I've submitted written testimony. I'm going to talk about a few points and mainly respond to some of the things I've heard. We are concerned that HB 2255 provides two ways in which farmland can be urbanized for speculative industrial development, through industrial reserves and through a supersiting process. As you've heard, the current urban reserve law is not an impediment for cities that show a need to designate urban reserves on farmland or to bring it into the UGB. Every city that currently has urban reserves has included farmland in those urban reserves and has brought it into the UGB, including Madras, Sandy, Newburgh, Ontario, and now every city in the Rogue Valley has urban reserves that include farmland through the regional problem-solving process. All of those include farmland. They've all been brought into it. For example, in 2009, Ontario approved a 2,200-acre urban reserve. Approximately 85% of that is high-value farmland. Ontario and Malheur County have now approved an amendment to the Ontario UGB to bring 310 acres of that land into the UGB, and it's now zoned for industrial, residential, and public facilities. If there's an issue that urban reserves aren't working, then I suggest a small change to the existing law about urban reserves, and that change would allow a city to designate an urban reserve for the sole purpose of an industrial use, rather than full panoply of urban uses. But it would still have to go through the hierarchy to show that farmland, if they chose to bring farmland into that reserve, was necessary. The premise underlying industrial reserves is flawed, and that premise is that more raw land at the edge of urban areas will grow jobs by attracting new large employers, and it ignores the far more important elements of job growth, including service land, a workforce with appropriate education. Yesterday's Oregonian showed that we have an education gap in our employment, not a land gap, financial incentives, and the fact that the overwhelming number of new jobs in Oregon and nationally come from smaller and existing businesses. I've seen the reports from the city of Hillsborough and from Business Oregon about the big fish that have come here kicking the tires. Those big fish are sometimes identified by their actual names and sometimes by code names. And I've seen the reasons they haven't located there on the printouts from Business Oregon and the city of Hillsborough. Rarely is land the issue. The issues are they decide to locate next to where they already are in some other part of the country or the world. They don't relocate at all. We are not providing the same financial incentives or infrastructure incentives that other regions of the country are, or we simply can't compete on a wage basis with off-site facilities. Land is rarely the issue. We hear lots of anecdotes about the one that got away, but we don't actually see facts about it. The issue is not land, and that is a distraction from the conversation that the legislature, I think, should be having. Land is, unfortunately, the tool DLCD has, but other state agencies have much more powerful tools, and I think that's what we should be talking about as a state. The Portland Business Alliance report, which has been cited earlier today, illustrates that. We have a lot of industrial land inside the Portland UGB, but much of it is challenged by needing infrastructure improvements, by needing aggregation of the parcels. Land is not the issue. But that land inside our urban growth boundaries is already close to where people live, where transit's available. It's close to ports and rail lines. That's where I think we should be making our investments, not on raw land at the edge, which is already pretty far away and needs all new infrastructure. The League of Cities 2013 report on the state of cities demonstrates that cities are facing severe financial troubles trying to keep up with the maintenance and operations of their existing infrastructure, and they're woefully behind in new infrastructure needed for just current development. Inside the Portland Metropolitan UGB, there is there are hundreds and hundreds of acres zoned for industrial use. Some of them are on the state certified ready-to-go list. Some have been there for a decade, and they haven't been occupied. The Senate Bill 766 process of the last session, we've designated four sites under that process. They're still ready to go. This bill deals very weakly with another major problem, which is the conversion of excellent industrial land to other uses. I served on a task force under the first Kitzhaber administration that the governor established, which documented the severe problem about conversion of industrial lands inside urban growth boundaries to other uses. That problem has not been addressed, and it's a severe one. Again, we're losing lands that are already well located near where people live and where the infrastructure exists, and this bill will perpetuate that bait and switch. Unlike the other two bills on which I testified, House Bill 2255 has not had nearly the degree of discussion, testing, and reworking that those other bills have. And therefore, you see there's no consensus of agreement on this bill. For example, the 5 miles. We have submitted a map that shows industrial sites in the Springfield-Goshen area. It includes a 400 to 500 acre proposed expansion of the UGB of Eugene next to the airport, which 1,000 Friends supports, a 300-acre Goshen proposed industrial site, which we also support, and an existing 200-acre industrial site that's rail-served in Springfield. Anyone would say that those sites are within the same economic shed, the same market, but they are all more than 5 miles away from each other. 5 miles doesn't get you from my house in southeast Portland to downtown Portland. And I ride my bike. I'm not far away. For the kinds of industries we're talking about, that is a very small distance. But we have not tested that because this group, the advisory group that you've heard described, was not able to turn because of the pressure of time to this bill until the very end. And frankly, we were meeting after this session started, long after we were supposed to be meeting, and long after most of the members had dropped off because they've been meeting for a year and a half. We have simply not tested these things in the same way we've tested them for the other elements of the other two bills. Another example is, you heard another speaker say, why 500 jobs on 150 acres? That's 3 jobs per acre. I think it's about the same ratio for the smaller-sized businesses. Why not 500? Why don't we encourage 500 jobs on 50 acres? I don't know why we have that demarcation there. It seems to me that we're treating businesses unequally if they're and they're getting penalized if they're more land efficient. Those are just a few of the problems that we see with this bill. And I'd also like to just close by saying House Bill 2254, the bill on urban growth boundaries, that process is for all uses for an urban growth boundary and streamlines the way in which cities can evaluate and expand their urban growth boundaries, including for industrial uses. We don't see a need for this bill. But certainly it hasn't been vetted enough to say that we understand what is in this bill or that we have picked the right characteristics. Thank you.
Questions for Mary Kyle? Let me just run one past you while...
What's that? Rep. Davis has.
Yeah, Rep. Davis has a question for you. So, you know, I'm trying to envision how this would be used either. Nobody's talked to me about any specific projects, nothing. But... I did recall reading something or going, so I was just reading it again to make sure I wasn't crazy. So the question is, adjacent to the UGB of Salem, let's say we take this Project Azalea, which is rumored to be a 1,000-job, $10 billion Apple insourcing from other country investment, and we show them the PickSuite property, and they're saying, it's 200, it's not even that, it's 100 and some acres. No. And then they turn around, they look across the street, and they see something, and they go, but that we would do. That's where I think the motivation comes from, because if we wanted to say yes, I have no idea what the city of Salem would have to do that. And that's, I think, the temptation. If it's that big of a fish, it's hard to say, as people mention, look, we'll go through a process to get the urban reserve figured out. That's, I think, the concern, because I don't know what kind of process that is. If there is a process that's easy to deal with, then I think, you know, we ought to point them towards that process. If there's not, then I think even if this bill doesn't go anywhere, we still got to keep talking about that kind of situation right there. Nothing, no Walmarts, no nothing, nothing like that, but something of that caliber. And it's hard to write bills for that. You at some point have to put it in the hands of some people you trust who are probably under non-disclosure agreements to be able to do something like that. I know that's pretty scary in our system to put power, a God squad, to be able to take advantage of something that major, but I think that's probably what people are thinking about.
Chair Clem, I understand the concern, but again, I'd like to go back to the facts. The Oregonian articles on Azalea, as well as the information from Business Oregon, from the City of Hillsborough, has shown that raw land is not the primary issue, sometimes not an issue at all, in terms of why industries choose to site in one place or another. For example, we have data centers in Prineville. The land was already there, zoned industrial, but they didn't locate until the legislature passed a tax thing that I'm not going to be able to describe to you what you all did. And there was an energy improvement needed, so they would have the assured energy, whatever it was you did. But that's what they needed. That's what they needed to locate, not the land. Here again, we need... We focus on raw land without any infrastructure, assuming that that's what's going to attract industries, and it hasn't proven to be the case yet, nor is that the reason, that primary reason, that most of industries have been locating somewhere else. Some haven't located anywhere else at all, or they've gone out of the country, or they've stayed where they already are. So in the Azalea case, they're looking at education and tax benefits that the state of New York offers. If it is, in fact, true that Azalea is Taiwan Semiconductor, then they already have a facility in Camas, Washington, and available land there. They may locate there. You know, here, there's land available. There's a governor state-certified site in Hillsborough that's been there for 10 years, that's several hundred acres, in addition to other lands, all in the Hillsborough, inside the UGB of Hillsborough. The land is there. I question whether that's really the issue driving it. We need flexibility.
This is helpful. Right. Remind me of that governor state certified. I forgot all about that. That was the shovel ready thing that Governor Kulongoski did, or it led to
it. I am not sure which governor.
And they created a bunch
state certified. I bet Peggy remembers. She's still here. they had the governor a state certified process that the Business Oregon certifies.
My vice chair reminds me there's only been two governors for quite a while to pick from.
But so they both start with the letter K.
And it both begins with a K. And it's multiple syllables.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. You can go to Business Oregon and you can find the number of certified sites that exist around Oregon, not just in that area. And then you can find a list of sites that are working on being certified. They may still need to have their wetlands delineation, or they may need one thing or another. But there are a number of sites that are state that are certified shovel ready. So,
and I
which governor did that?
Kulongoski, I believe.
That's right. Thank you.
I'd like to add also that we look at the Ontario situation. As I said, they have a 2,200-acre urban reserve. They've brought hundreds of acres into the urban growth boundary. It's farmland. But they're also located only 55 miles from Boise. I would think that that's a larger factor on what kinds of businesses are going to locate in what parts of that larger region. However, agriculture is possibly the top industry in Malheur County. I haven't looked it up, so I don't want to assert that for sure, but I bet if it's not number one, I bet it's number two. It's the number one industry in Marion County. That is an industry that cannot be outsourced, that will not be going overseas, that will not shift to Austin or New York or whatever. That is a resource we have here and that we should grow. We've heard the examples of NORPAC locating or expanding its facility in Salem, and the facility that went into McMinnville, I believe, is a food processing facility that Sid had talked about. The number two in value product exported out of the Port of Portland is agricultural products. Multnomah County is the number one food processing county in the state. These are all intertwined, and that is an industry that did not experience a recession during the time that the high-tech manufacturing and the housing industry did. It continued to grow. I suggest that's where we should be putting our emphasis. Thank you.
Don't forget Amy's Kitchens in the Southern Oregon area, which chose to continue to have their plant there and expand there because the quality of the produce and the organic produce that they needed was better in Oregon than it was in New York, where they were looking to relocate.
What's wrong with Hood River food? Okay, I think we've expired ourselves for the evening. Thank you for staying, and sure. I'm going to
a comment to follow up. I heard you say this would not be a Walmart. The bill says it has to be a traded sector industry. It's not service jobs.
Yeah. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2255. Do I have to carry over anything?
Yeah, if you want to, you need to carry over. If you want to carry these over.
Okay, I think we might have a shot at voting on at least 2253 and 2254 on Tuesday, so I will carry over House Bills 2253, 2254, and 2255 to Tuesday, and I'll adjourn the committee.
Yep.